remember.
This is slide number four in the slide.
And she sees this together with, in the briefing documents, which also was also being circulated. There's a lot of insight on pages 3, 4, and 6 of the PC briefing document. I think what's important to mention is that what the first circle, the green and the red, doesn't segregate is between those that are just financially unqualified with other issues and those that are, you know, as Lotus mentioned, clean. Now in the portfolio we've got 9 entities, 4 are clean. And the briefing document which I referred to on pages 3, 4 and 6 actually detail which 4 are clean. It's the NPA, President's Fund, Guardians Fund and Legal Aid South Africa. So that's the 5 entities. So out of the 5, 4 are financially unqualified, so in the green for your financial statements, but they've got other issues and you'll see it's a compliance. So that's how we reconcile it to the 9. So I'm not going to focus on those, on the financial statements element, but specifically the red is the one that we will speak about. And as can be seen in the legend, we're talking of an adverse or a disclaimer. And that specific entity is the third-party funds, which has received a disclaimer of audit opinion. Just to give some insight into that fund, historically, the entity didn't submit financials for at least 3 to 4 years in the past. And around 2012, an effort was made to sort of clear the backlog. And at this point in time, all audits have been finalized up to 2013-14. In other words, the entity is now up to date with its submission of financial statements. However, the legacy issues continue to remain, which are plaguing from moving to an unqualified opinion. And we'll just give you some insight into what those issues are. Firstly, it's an information system that is utilized to prepare the financial statements. It's what we refer to as JDAS, and the briefing document talks about that. It's a Justice Deposit Accounting System, which is purely an administrative system. So in other words, its function is just to record money in and money out. It doesn't have any functionality or capability to enable preparation of financial reports in order to enable the preparation of financial statements. So that is one key element that must be fixed in order to move this entity to at least a better audit outcome. Secondly is the discipline in terms of daily and monthly controls. What we are saying there is that daily cash-ups, daily reconciliations, monthly reconciliations of beneficiary accounts, etc. So that is what we are talking about there, and daily and monthly reconciliations of bank accounts. The third element there that we like to highlight is the issue of record keeping. In other words, to have a system in place where every balance and every transaction has supporting documentation to back up the transactions that are recorded in the accounting system. Specifically because of the historical challenges, the approach that could be undertaken to fix the system and to procure a new system, etc., it's a multi-year commitment or it's a multi-year project which might take 2 to 3 years to resolve. So we have recommended to management, and it is also in the briefing document, that what could be the quick wins in terms of manual interventions that could be implemented to mitigate the system issues. And those are specifically the 2 or 3 elements that I mentioned now, is to get the record keeping side of it fixed. In other words, at a court level, to ensure that all closing balances are backed up by credible evidence, and all transactions that take place during the year are actually supported by adequate supporting documentation. And the more critical one maybe is to instill discipline in terms of daily and monthly controls. And by that means that bring daily cash up, bring daily reconciliation in terms of what was received for the day, what was paid up for the day, has it been correctly allocated to the correct beneficiary, and bring proper bank reconciliation in terms of the funds that are in the bank accounts, who do they belong to, can it be reconciled to the creditors. So that's basically some insight into the financial statements. When we come to compliance with legislation, there's basically 3 elements. The one is that it's the supply chain management issues that are plaguing some of the entities in the form. And then we're talking about deviations, not obtaining three quotations, not complying with the bid specifications, not complying with with bids in terms of going out on tender, etc. And the other element is that a few of the entities submit financial statements which on 31st of May still contain material misstatements which must then be corrected in order to enable the audit outcome to be unqualified. Now specifically there, I would like to highlight one of the entities. I'll just make a passing comment in that the department itself just has one or two line items which basically are not in the accounting system but are manually driven accounts in the disclosure notes, and one of them is lease commitments. So what we mention, what we mean by that is that it does not feature throughout the year in the accounting system which is used because the department prepares financials on a modified cash basis. It then has disclosure notes that it is to populate in the financial statements which require manual systems. And in order to enable these commitments to be accurately and completely disclosed, there's a lot of reliance on other parties, for example, in the regions, etc., to submit that information. So what we find is the information that's been submitted to management before 31st of May is not accurate. The audit then reveals some deficiencies which are then corrected during the audit, and then the opinion is unqualified. So we would like to highlight that it's not the department that's the main culprit there. However, there is one budget that you see in the financial statements block, the arrow going up means that there's an improvement. And the improvement is related to the Human Rights Commission. So the Human Rights Commission last year was qualified. In 2013-14, it moved to an unqualified opinion. However, there were material statements in that entity which had then to be corrected in order to move it to an unqualified situation. But we feel that, or we find that the systems in place and the controls that are in place throughout the year are not adequate to give us comfort that the interventions that they've implemented is sustainable. So what we mean by that is that we don't have a sense of comfort that there's been enough effort in terms of daily, monthly controls and reconciliations to give us a sense of assurance that the entity has really moved to a position where it's sustainably unqualified. So there are certain interventions that need to be put in place there. In the last area of performance report, now what we will find is that there's 9 entities in financial statements, there's 9 on compliance, but there's only 6 on performance reports. The reason being is that there are 3 funds, which is Guardian's Fund, President's Fund, and third party funds, which are not public entities, which are not PFMA listed entities. So they are just funds that are there to perform a specific function. And they do not have enabling legislation that requires them to prepare performance reports. So therefore, we only have 6 performance reports. Now, on the 6 performance reports, all of those entities are basically have given unqualified conclusions. However, we just need to mention 2 entities. The one is the Department of Justice, which had material misstatements in his performance report. So similar to the financial statements, when any performance report is presented to us on the 31st of May, during the audit, some material discrepancies were identified, which then had to be corrected, which management rectified. We re-audited those outcomes, and then we were satisfied that the performance report on all the programs that we've audited sort of correctly reflects the actual status of events. So that's the one. The other is the SIU, Special Investigating Unit, which had a non-compliance issue in that the strategic plan was not submitted to the executive authority, to the minister for approval for 13-14. So those are basically the 2 issues that were highlighted in the audit report. But from a reliability point of view and from a usefulness point of view, meaning that in terms of the targets, the indicators, and the achievements at year end, we were satisfied with those 6 performance reports. So that's basically a summary of the issues in the portfolio. What I would then like to do is, in the briefing document, we do have on page 17, basically a summary of where we find that the portfolio committee could make some input into trying to improve the audit outcomes in the portfolio. And one of the key issues that we would like to highlight is tracking the progress of the implementation of action plans. In other words, entities will not develop action plans in terms of how are they going to address the audit findings. And what we normally do in that process is that we try to give some direction to the entities to see what should an action plan contain. Firstly, it should have all audit findings, whether it's internal audit or external audit. And normally in the internal audit reports and the external audit reports which are issued by the AG, in the management reports we do highlight the root causes of what we feel was the actual reason for the finding being raised. So the action plan must then address the root cause rather than addressing the audit findings. It should address the root cause that actually led to the audit finding, and then there should be a responsibility allocated to a specific line manager or line management function. I mean, there should be proper time frames in order to deliver on those commitments. What we find generally is that the timings that are normally given are year-end, which we feel doesn't work. There should be actions being put in place throughout the year to ensure that by year-end, those findings are resolved. If you have a time frame at year-end, and if those actions are not actually delivered at year-end, you then going to be sitting with a situation where you're going to have repetitive audit findings, which is the case currently. So we'd like the committee to try and focus on the action plans, to get focus on the action plans, to review the action plans, etc., in order to ensure that at least the root causes of the rise to the audit findings are resolved. Now this document as well, on page six, we have basically what I've mentioned to the committee from the slide is all captured on page six of the briefing document. And it's a very useful tool to be given a snapshot as to what is the status of each of the entities. And you'll find that we haven't really mentioned much about the IT controls, because the IT controls do not directly impact on the audit outcome. So in other words, all of the entities do have some work, except for Legal Aid South Africa, to be done on the IT side, which is the information technology side, and it's mainly around the user account management, where we're talking about password control and access control. And we also mentioned quite a bit in the briefing document around the disaster recovery plans and backups that are not adequate. The specific entity that is red is the third-party funds, and I mentioned earlier on what is the actual situation with regard to third-party funds in terms of the inadequacies in the accounting system that need to be rectified. Management is aware of the situation, and there are commitments as well to rectify the situation. However, as I mentioned earlier, that this is probably a project that's going to take at least 18 months to 24 months, which is about 2 years, and by then we would have had another audit report to look at. So what I mentioned earlier then in terms of the daily disciplines, monthly disciplines, and the manual interventions are critical in order to ensure that at least the audit outcomes moves positively in absence of the system working effectively. So I think, Chairperson, that is basically a synopsis of the portfolio, and we welcome any questions.
How can we, the portfolio committee, assist the department in oversight to improve particularly the third-party management, third-party funds. Another 18 to 24 months, you understand that's almost 20 years of backlogs. That might be an understatement. It's say 10 years, but it's a very long period that we understand, and we need to get an indication when will we get it sorted out. And that's the historical side. But again, the current situation is that being carefully and properly monitored. Thank you, Chair.
Any other question?
Thank you, Chair. This might have been explained when I was outside, but after that, I'm quite curious to know the area one disclaimer, which area it is. If you look at this diagram, which the diagram is reported, just to indicate what area. And then when it comes to intervention required, which is my document does not have pages for this one. There is intervention that is that amount to 56%, which can actually indicate it.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Chairperson, specifically with regard to the third-party funds, the system issue, as correctly mentioned, will take some time. So what we are basically engaged with management and the audit committee on is that what are the quick wins, or what are the interventions that can be put in place, and without being too optimistic to say, well, it's going to be unqualified, at least we'll move it to a better outcome of a qualified, and then slowly to move it up to an unqualified, because the legacy issues, as mentioned, and the honourable member, is a reality. So the approach that should be undertaken is that at least to get the in-year disciplines correct. In other words, to operate in an environment that operates as a cash environment should. Now, if we go into a banking system or a supermarket environment, there's daily cash-ups. In other words, how much of money was received can actually account for the funds that we receive. Who should those funds actually, whose account should it be deposited into, etc. The amounts of money that was paid, who was it paid to, can we then ensure that on a daily basis the correct beneficiary is updated with the correct information. So that would be the first, you know, the starting point, to have each transaction correctly recorded on a daily basis, and then to do cash-ups and do reconciliation at the end of each day. Secondly, is to ensure them that bank reconciliations as well, because of the environment that we operate, it's a fund that administers about 3 billion rand worth of funds, of, you know, money on an annual basis. So it's to do bank reconciliations as well on a daily basis. And that will then determine as to every cent or all funds that we receive in the bank account can be reconciled again to the beneficiaries to ensure that those are correctly recorded. Then to do bank reconciliations on a monthly basis as well, to ensure that the amount of money that you're sitting with on your record can be reconciled to what's sitting in the bank account. Now currently we have a situation where there are unreconciled differences which are called system errors, and that no one can explain as what is a system error, how did it arise, who is going to fix it, how can it be fixed, where did it arise, etc. So those are some of the issues that must be looked at, and you need CETAs help in that situation. The next area is on record management. Now we are aware that records for years in back might be a challenge, but what we are saying is that at least for the records for all transactions taking place in that particular year, so now we're talking of 14-15, make sure that for every receipt and payment you do have supporting documentation at court level to back up each of those transactions. That will go a long way to ensuring that going forward you will move to a more positive audit outcome. Then the last area that must be addressed is the area of, we call it closing balances, because we do know that the opening balances issues are not going to be resolved, because they are going back many, many years. So what we are advocating is work from the closing balance. In other words, at the end of March, make sure that the balance you have as your creditor's balance can be explained by means of going back to individual records. And those records must be backed up by the documentation for the year. By doing that, you may have some issues with the opening banners of the year, but at least know that in the next year, the banners that you are taking forward are credible. So those are some of the things that you think will go a long way in moving the outcome. And as I said, not being optimistic and unqualified, but at least, you know, try to improve it over the next year or two to move it in a positive direction. Now the system is critical, and what I mentioned now in these points is assuming, or in the absence of a system, these things can still be put in place to ensure that at least the inefficiencies or the inadequacies in the system can be mitigated by these manual interventions. Then once you get onto the new system, these manual interventions, if correctly done, will ensure that whatever balances you take forward onto the new system, all of the information has been verified and is credible, so that your new system then moves on to a new platform, which is a more accurate platform, which will give you, you know, proper financial reports. Then the issue around the disclaimer is on the third-party fund. The fund is basically, it's a trust account. There is no income statement. In other words, there's no income, there's no expenditure. It's just basically a trust fund which has a bank balance, and theoretically it has creditors that it must pay off because it holds money on behalf of other individuals or on behalf of other organizations. So the challenge you sit in with this environment is you basically got three line items on your financial statements. So it's your bank balance, it's your trust creditors, and then you've got shortages. Which, in other words, it means that theoretically your bank balance should equal to the amount of money you owe to individuals. However, in this environment, you've got shortages. So in other words, there's a discrepancy between the bank balance and your trust creditors, which are the shortages. In other words, money that could not be accounted for, etc. And this is, again, a historical issue because of the history of non-submissions of financial statements. There wasn't really control around that. So we're sitting at roughly around 60 million rand that needs to be looked into and investigated and either recovered or a decision must be taken as to how the department will fix the area. And it is in the annual report as well. So you're sitting there basically with three line items, and each of those line items has got challenges which come back to these three fundamentals. In other words, the system, the daily and monthly disciplines, and the record keeping. So if those things can be fixed, we go back to each of the closing balances, make sure that the in-year reporting is accurate, that the records for in-year transactions, we think that could at least move the situation positively in the future.
Thank you for that, Mr. Isaac. I understand the legacy issues, and that I've sat for almost 15 years as we've been trying to resolve it every year, and we do see an improvement. You indicate that 60 million is that, and I just haven't had the time to study the financial statements, but is that all legacy, or is it also ongoing? My concern now, and the department can need a response from that, is where you said there are unreconciled differences in system errors now as well. So besides the legacy issue, we as portfolio committee members need to know there are problems in the current system as well. And so there are two issues now. So the current system, because we understand obviously that shortage has to be guaranteed by the state. And because there's no records, there could be bribery or corruption or could be theft of the funds of that 60 million I'm talking about. But we appreciate the legacy problems. But is it snowball now? And we need the department also to give a clear indication of why are these unreconciled differences and system errors taking place now. Thank you very much.
Honorable Kumulo.
I just wanted some clarification on the 2013 of Human Rights Commission. The colors are, I'm not quite familiar with the colors. They are much changed. There's a qualified in the 2012, 2013 financial year on South African Human Rights Day. and there's also, does it mean non-compliance with the law? Is that what it means? When you talk about irregular expenditure, what do you actually mean? Do you mean illegal? Or how serious is this? Is what I want to say, because you use terms like irregular, and I don't know what you mean in your terms by irregular. Do you mean in legal terms? Are you talking about unlawful? Or is it perhaps unauthorized? Or is that what you are saying?
Mr. Yusuf, I'm just wondering whether we are not trying to do the impossible. If you have legacy problems going back to 15 years, and you have these responsibilities that must be carried out currently, are we sure that in terms of the personnel, we have the capacity to deal with the legacy problems and to make sure that we cope with the current challenges?
Thank you, sir. In terms of third party funds, what I wanted to have is a clarity in terms of disclaimer in the first place. Normally when it's a disclaimer, you realize that the situation is dire. And with third party funds, the impression that we've been given as a committee was that we are giving the decision. But what's being said now, it's almost like saying no, we're not giving the. And I think we're going to really require some form of classification as to why we're not going there. We do understand that there's a legacy problem, but we have to actually come to a situation where we actually put systems in place that is make allow us as a country to move forward when it comes to areas of this nature. Because it's areas that actually deals with huge sums of money. And if you're going to have 60 million that's not accounted for, means we really have a serious problem in this regard. So basically, my worry would be that we were aware as a committee of this area as problematic, and we have been reassured that you are really putting all systems and efforts in place to make it work. Why are we continuing to have a big problem?
In line with that, I don't know who we are trying to hold accountable, because if you are correct in saying that there are systematic, problems, you don't know how they arose. Nobody knows how they arose. Nobody knows how to deal with them. Now, what are we trying to do? Where do we find the solution? Because if the people that are responsible running the departments cannot be blamed for those issues, and we say they must be fixed, we don't know where they are also, where are we? So we can't come back next year and then blame the people responsible for not fixing the problem, because nobody knows where the problem comes from. So what do we do in such a situation?
We must honor the Human Rights Commission first. The audit outcome in 12-13 was a qualified audit opinion, meaning that there were certain errors in the financial statements which could not be rectified by management. An auditor was not satisfied with those areas. And if you look into the audit report, it's on property, land and equipment, which is basically fixed assets, and your creditors. So those were the two areas that were qualified. So the entities managed to fix them during the 13-14. However, we mentioned earlier in the presentation that we as auditors don't get the sense or comfort that it may be sustainable. In other words, the interventions that we are putting in place were still not adequate, and the audit process still revealed certain discrepancies which were then corrected by management, and it's more a reliance on audit process rather than the daily and the monthly disciplines actually leading into an unqualified opinion in the 13-14 financial year. With regards to irregular expenditure, it is defined in the PFMA as expenditure that you made not in compliance basically with the law. And mainly in our presentation, in our audit findings, we pick up non-compliance in two areas, which is the irregular expenditure, and the other area is the financial statements containing the statements. Now, specifically on irregular expenditure, mainly in almost all instances, they are as a result of non-compliance with supply chain management regulations. Now, it does not mean that you've committed fraud, it does not mean that it's illegal, etc. The PFMA requires the accounting officer to ensure that there's systems in place to prevent, and if you couldn't prevent it, you must detect the irregular expenditure, and you need to put in systems in place to prevent it in the first place. So we can commend that the service was delivered. So there was no invalid or you know, fraudulent transaction. It is that the compliance with the actual regulation. In other words, if you have to go out and get 3 codes, you may have got 2 codes. If you have to get a tax clearance certificate, you may not have got a valid tax clearance certificate. If you have to go out on a tender, you actually went out on codes. So those are some of the discrepancies that would have been identified leading to irregular expenditure. It does not mean there was fraud. It does not mean that the goods or service were not received or delivered. So that's basically on the Human Rights Commission and the irregular expenditure. Then on third-party funds, there are interventions in place to capacitate the court. And, I mean, the department can give further input in the sense that you need and are making some intervention in getting individuals who've got some financial background. In other words, they do have some financial knowledge into what should the internal control be. How should you go about recording transactions? What should you look at in recording transactions? What should you look at on the system? If there's a discrepancy on the system, how do you go about reconciling it and resolving resolving it? So there are some moves in that direction. Then with regards to the shortages, the majority, or if you have to really look at it, the cash shortages, or those shortages that are as a result of discrepancies between what was received and what was recorded, that is reducing. So in other words, almost the bulk of the shortages are the legacy issues. And what we mentioned there was that not all of the shortages are definite cash shortages. But there are system errors in there which are legacy system issues and which cannot be explained as to why did the system do something in a certain way, how did the system error arise. And if the reconciliations take place, as you mentioned, the daily and monthly disciplines, those system errors will be picked up almost daily or weekly or monthly, and they'll be investigated and rectified by the next month. Now, when it comes to system errors, you need the help of CETA to know why is the system doing something a certain way. Now, the other complexity to the whole situation is that you do not have one system or IT system that is consistent throughout your 400 or 500 cores. Each core operates on its own version of data, which also complicates the situation in the sense that if I'm sitting in Bloemfontein and I pick up a system error, my system error will then be rectified, but it may apply to other systems in other cores who may not have picked up the system error, and therefore you are then sitting with errors in those cores which no one has identified or picked up. So with the new system, if it's an integrated system, when it's a system that's rolled out consistently throughout every core, as soon as an error is identified or there's a patch that needs to be put in place, it will be rolled out consistently throughout all of the cores. So basically, in summary, what we are seeing is that the majority of the issues in with regards to the shortages are legacy issues or systematic issues that are in the past. We hope that the interventions that we are proposing, that if there's cash shortages, it will be identified almost on a daily basis if these controls are put in place. Because you know by the end of each day what are the shortages, how much of it is cash, what are the system errors that you identified in that day, and then you log upon with CETA, and then you follow up to make sure that by the next month, at least, it is not picked up daily, at least by the end of the month, and by the next month, it is sort of rectified. And with moving the capacity in the direction of employing those who actually have some financial ability that should go some way in ensuring that there's at least some financial skill which knows what to look for when identifying these shortages, system errors, discrepancies, irreconciliations, etc. Now, I'd like to go back and again summarize as to, with all these concerns in terms of capacity, you know, legacy issues, issues going back many years, etc. What we are advocating is that we do know that if you have to go back and try to obtain records to say, well, let me try and see what should the balance have been as at 1 April 2013, you're not going to be able to do that because of all the historical issues. So what we are proposing is that, and that is why I said not being optimistic that it's going to be unqualified or whatever, but at least it can move a demand or another entity to a better outcome and then progressively move it to unqualified. Is that we are saying start with, at this point in time, so assuming we are now 31 March 2015, what should my financial situation look like? In other words, I know what my bank balance is. If my controls are in place throughout the year, I should not have a problem knowing what is my bank balance, because I've got a bank statement to confirm that. If my accounting records confirms my bank balance, then I've got comfort that what's sitting in my books and my bank balance is actually funds that are sitting in my bank account. So that's something that could be easy to be done if the disciplines are in place. Then your next item that you need to look at is, okay, what should my creditors' balance be? My accounting records are telling me it's a certain amount. Am I able to reconcile that to my beneficiary listing? In other words, if I have 1,000 individuals making up that balance, I've got comfort that I am able to explain each of them. So I'm able to explain the one-line item by having a list of creditors, which then gives me comfort that my systems have been working in place all the year. Now, in this environment, it's not going to happen like that, because your opening balance feeds into your closing balance. So what you're basically saying is that start a process in place now to say, right, what should my creditors' balance be at this point in time? In other words, what is the amount that I'm comfortable I'm able to explain that these are valid transactions? And these are the balances that I'll have to pay out. If you have that, and the daily controls for this year are in place, opening balance is something that can be ring-fenced, and we can then identify how we will resolve that. Or a decision could be taken as to how that, in terms of the accounting sense, how that can be sort of unpacked, and how it can be rectified via a journal or any other intervention. But at least we will know what is the extent of the error. And then, if it means that it leads to qualification for this year, well, that is what it could be. But at least in the future, you know that balance that you're taking over in the next year is the correct balance, which has been audited, the auditor is satisfied, you as management are satisfied. So at least then it moves, when moving forward, you know you're taking on balances with integrity. With regards to the shortages, those have to be investigated to know exactly what is a system shortage and what are the cash shortages. Now, by and large, there are certain large amounts in which management has looked into and they are able to explain, or they have investigated, and they just need to now conclude those investigations as to what makes up those amounts. So not all of the shortages are funds that cannot be accounted for. Some of them, as we said, are system shortages. But those need to be investigated, explained, and then the decision can be taken as to how those will be rectified.
Honourable members, I think that the briefing really empowers the department and the entities to take this matter forward. I think the 60 million doesn't mean there's any doom and gloom. It's a clear way forward. Are we happy with that? Yeah. I'm so happy with your team. Thank you very much. I think you have done a very good work, which will empower all concerned to be able to move forward. So we shouldn't lament. We wanted to identify where the sticky points are, and we identified them. We made good recommendations, and that's all we wanted, that the department improved. Thank you very much.
Chair, and thank you to the honourable members of the committee. We are grateful to be here. We also note that this committee, just a couple of weeks ago, also allowed space for civil society to engage, so we just want to appreciate that. We hope what we present will be useful to you, at least in your work. Just to comment quickly on the photographs, so my colleague, Mr. Ntoiwa, would like to simply take some pictures of us for the newsletters and so on. We're not planning to Twitter strange pictures of committee members and so forth. It's not our intention. Thank you. So my name is Samantha or Sam Waterhouse, and I am working in the parliamentary program of the Community Law Centre, which is based at the University of the Western Cape. And my work is really to work with alliances and civil society on certain key issues, particularly around women and children's rights, and try and increase the extent to which we are engaging with our legislators broadly. So trying to make sure that civil society and the public on other occasions are more involved in the work of the legislatures. So I wanted to also say that we will be commenting today on three documents, and I'm not sure how many of you have read a third of that, because it was hidden down in the bottom of the file, in the bottom of the file. So we're looking at the Department of Justice and then Constitutional Development Annual Report, the National Prosecuting Authority Annual Report. And then we found in our package, much to our joy, an updated performance report from the Department on Sexual Offences Implementation. And we're aware you had a report from them about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago now, but that was an outdated report, so we were pleased to see the new figures. We've asked to present with our colleagues from Shugumisa, because the Community Law Centre is a member of that campaign. My colleague will introduce to you very briefly who the Shugumisa campaign is and why I want to speak, but the main point I wanted to make was that we'll be focusing specifically on sexual offences. That's an area of our expertise. And we've worked very much in preparing this presentation with the Resources Aimed at Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect, or RAPCAN, and my colleagues from RAPCAN, who did all the hard work, are in the room, who had undertaken research with children, with their parents or caregivers, and with court support workers in a number of courts around the Western Cape over the past few years. And so we tried to bring to you some of the reflections from those people on the ground into our conversation around policy priorities and so forth. So,
good morning, Chairperson and honourable members. My name is Vivian Mentor-Lalo, and I'm the coordinator for the Shugumisa campaign. So just very briefly, because we want to get through quite a bit and we realize we're running in our schedule somewhat, that the Shumisa campaign started in about 2004, but it was known as the National Working Group on Sexual Offences. And it started then specifically focusing on what was in the Sexual Offences Bill and engaging with civil society around making input and participating in the processes to form the bill into an act. When the bill became an act at the end of 2007, the working group then reconstituted itself as the Shumisa campaign, and its primary focus is looking at the implementation of Sexual Offences Act and policies and other matters that impact on sexual offences in South Africa. Currently, we have about 45 members in civil society, large NGOs across South Africa. All these members have as a core key function issue the issue of sexual offences. And we have a range of members. They do things from direct services to survivors of sexual offences. There's a lead organization that focus on research, that focus on advocacy, and working with both adults and child survivors of sexual offences. So just that hope that gives you a quick idea of who I'm representing for Kenya today. We want to give you a very quick snapshot looking at sexual offences, and we wanted to start at the point where survivors would start in the criminal justice system, which is a stat that we found around the reporting of sexual offences at police station points. And you can see there's an average of about 60 plus thousand reported cases over the last few years, consistently more or less. We wanted to draw your attention to the fact that across the world and in South Africa, there's unanimous acceptance that this figure represents a serious underreporting, and that we know far more survivors of sexual offences do not report their cases and do not enter the criminal justice system. And some of our partners and colleagues are specifically looking at what are barriers to reporting sexual offences. And we're currently working with the Civilian Secretariat for Police to begin to see if we can assist SAPS in formulating some policy to really make meaningful interventions around being to lift some of the barriers that survivors face. Another key concern that the members of Shumisa have is this policy of SAPS to reduce serious violent crime by 7%. Now, the facing of that might make sense, but in terms of how this has translated into police stations, it's been quite concerning for us, and our members report to us that what happens is that police in the police stations actively try to discourage survivors from making report of cases so that they meet their targets. And so we want to draw your attention that looking at the stats is not as simple as what it seems. So a drop in reporting does not indicate that there's a drop in sexual offences in our country. Also, we wanted to briefly touch on myths and misconceptions around sexual offences. And the reason why we want to draw your attention to what may seem very obvious to many of you sitting in the room is that we recognize that societal attitudes, there are large amounts of pervasive misconceptions around rape in our society. But we wanted to draw your attention that many of the people working within the criminal justice system hold some of the misconceptions. And we wanted to just begin to highlight some of the main ones to you. You can see on the slide from victim blaming to this notion that all perpetrators are crazy, lurking in the shadows, only coming out at night. We also wanted to draw your attention to the idea of scapegoating the victim of sexual violence, and that if a victim is not quite hard enough, she must have somehow wanted it. Those are some of the main, there are many more, but those are some of the sort of main misconceptions that prevail within society, and we believe with people working in the criminal justice system as well. And the reason why we wanted to draw your attention to that, other than the serious effect on the survivor that these myths and misconceptions have, we also believe that it does impact on what happens in the criminal justice system, and it has an impact on the outcome of cases that are proceeding through the criminal justice system. And we know that that some of the reasons why survivors do not come forward and do not pursue criminal prosecution is soundly based in the continuation of these perceptions that prevail within the criminal justice system. So survivors really fear that their privacy and confidentiality will be breached within the system.
They have a low fear of poor and even abusive treatment by officials in the system, and a very real fear that the system cannot keep them safe. And those are just some of the reasons that we know why the violence do not even come forward to the cases within the criminal justice system. I'm handing over to Sam for the next slide.
Thank you. So, one day. So, I think members are probably aware, and certainly Shugulisa members are aware, that the developments in this country over the last 20 years to policy framework, to the law, to programs around sexual offences have been significant. When we've seen from the Department of Justice, including SATS, National Prosecuting Authority, many different initiatives to make a change that will affect the picture that is affecting so many South Africans. I want to point out that you're thinking about 60,000 rapes reported this year. There were 60,000 last year, 60,000 the year before. If you go back 4 or 5 years, you're talking about 250,000-300,000 reported cases. So the people living amongst us that are affected by this, it's a huge proportion of our society. So there has been a strong response from the legislature and from the department, and we really want to recognize that. Part of what we'll be doing is to look at, in looking at what we've changed, why are certain things still not getting fixed? Now, we can't address, but the Department of Justice can't address why people are raping. They can only address what happens afterwards. So we're not going to talk about how to reduce rape to this committee, but more how we feel some of the responses from the department could be improved. Noting also just for the committee that the changes in the law didn't just affect the definition of rape, which was one of the big things that the law changed. It also went into practice in the courts. It looked at the rules of the court, the rules of evidence, and tried to find ways to address those misconceptions that pervade in the jurisprudence and in the practices of the court. I wanted to just say that that act is far-reaching in terms of the positive changes that it tried to make. And then, of course, I think this committee is well aware of the policy directives for a range of departments that the Act requires and a very high level of parliamentary oversight. And I've noted in two meetings, one with this present committee and one with the previous committee, there's been mention that perhaps the oversight required on the department is too high because they're not always meeting the deadlines. And certainly as civil society, we would really caution against lowering that. There's an annual requirement, which you're well aware of, for reporting. And we would say that given the fact that the situation is still not changing very well in spite of everything that's been done, we still need a high level of oversight and guidance. And that's not to suggest there isn't a wealth of expertise in the department, but it's about a forum in which we can analyze and try and take things further. In addition to the change in the law, we've seen sexual offence courts. We saw them rise and fall and then be reinstated through law that came through at the beginning of last year. The truth is they are one-stop centres. There were many different names for them. They've been focused into one-stop service centres. Court preparation services to survivors at court. We know about the Victims Charter, the Victim Empowerment Program, and so forth. So we really are seeing a lot, if you read these policies and you look at what the programs entail, there's very good understanding at quite a high level about what is needed. But what we're constantly seeing is that the commitment to resourcing these is lagging. And that's one of our major questions to this committee, is the issue of how do we ensure that these very good policies and programs are resourced going forward to meet the scale of need. I want to point out the reason why I'm saying not a lot has changed. When you read the National Prosecuting Authority's annual report, you'll see a conviction rate of around 67%. 65 for 1 year, 66 another year. It's not phenomenally good, 67%. I'm alarmed that as we've read the annual reports over years and years and years, we see less and less information in them. In the annual report before this committee, all we see is the conviction rate, which is measuring only the cases that were in court. Doesn't even count the cases that went to the NPA, that were referred to the court. So literally that 67% is the cases that go into a courtroom where there is a trial and where there's conviction. So it is good, and we appreciate the work that's being done in the court, but we're highly concerned that we're not even seeing in the annual report the issues of cases being struck off the roll, cases being withdrawn. If you look back a few years, you would have seen that information in the main annual report. The reason we have it is because we've got the requirements of Parliament that the department, that in fact the Intersectoral Committee, report annually. Also, you'll see throughout, there's very much confusion about the numbers. The National Prosecuting Authority annual report says there were 5,484 convictions last year. Department of Justice and Constitutional Development said there were 4,401. So there are different figures, and we see the same with the statistics, which I know isn't the primary concern of this committee. But it makes it difficult to really figure out what's going on. I'm sure there's a reason for the difference in numbers. I think it would be useful to know why that there's such a big difference in numbers, about 1,000 cases difference. Also, I wanted to say that the very encouraging in the Department of Justice annual progress report, they actually are indicating that they will be looking into why so many cases are being struck off the roll, which actually isn't our greatest concern. It was about 1,700 cases struck off the roll. The numbers of withdrawn cases are about the same as the number of convictions. So just understand, 60,000 to the police every year translates into what looks like 10,000 new cases going into the NPA every year. They have a backlog of about 10,000 and a new 10,000. So they're working with about 20,000 cases in the NPA every year. Of those, 5,000 are resulting in a report, in a confession, excuse me, and another 5,000 are being withdrawn. So if you look at these cases and you start doing the sums, you see a conviction rate of around 7%. Now, with the new figures, usually highest number given by the NPA and the lowest number given by the SAS, so giving them the best possible outcome, would be an improvement of around 9% conviction rate. If you use SAS's higher reported number and the Department of Justice's lower conviction rate, it goes down to about 6%. It's difficult to tell. If you look at research done in 2000, the conviction rate was 7%. So 14 years down the line, the big concern is that the conviction rate doesn't seem to have changed. And if you see the case tracking research that's being done, which is more robust conviction rates than what we can do by saying, comparing the SAPS figures in 1 year with the same year's figures in clusters, we see alarming things. And this showed us a very different picture around the country and why it's so important for our members to ensure that the policy cuts across the experiences across the country. Because there are some courts doing relatively well, but in some cases, like one particular police station in Mpumalanga, where cases over a period of years were tracked from reporting at that police station to what resulted in the conviction in the court that was relevant to that site, we saw a conviction rate of 4.1% for children and 0.8% for adults. So you saw an almost unlikely, a huge unlikeliness that adult women's cases would result in a conviction. And just to point out, if you've got 7% conviction rate, it means 93 out of every 100 perpetrators or alleged perpetrators is walking free. So just to understand what it means, you know, for survivors, what it means. So I wanted to say there's other ways also to measure outcomes. So there's a conviction rate, some quite useful, are victim satisfaction or client satisfaction surveys. There were a couple undertaken in Tutuzela Center, in a Tutuzela Center a few years ago. Internationally, they're undertaken in certain cases, well-resourced countries, of course. But they tell us other things. They tell us, for example, that sometimes, even when there's no conviction, a survivor may be satisfied with the justice outcomes because they feel that they've been heard in the system. So it may be quite useful to try and consider how to do those kinds find that kind of information, because I think it tells us more about the way the system is working than simply looking at the conviction rate. And then I lastly want to say we do see improvement, and I'll be giving you some examples later where people themselves are saying this is working well. But the problem is those are very isolated and small pockets of improvement in the system, in the people's experiences of the system. And then because of the fact that people feel unsupported in the system, there are huge withdrawals. If I've been raped, I live every day in my household, every day in my community, in my school, and I'm constantly bombarded by that impact. When I go to a court and people don't have time for me and the accused still harasses me, I'm less likely to continue the case because I actually need it to be over. I need to move on with my life.
So we want to start talking about what can we do differently. And Sam already mentioned that we acknowledge the strong investments already made in our policy and law reform in this regard. And we also recognize that the problems within the criminal justice system, they are complex problems, and therefore the solutions will definitely require us to apply our mind and also to look at a range of overlapping interventions. And so we want to just start talking to you about some of the ideas already there within the system and the Department of Justice already undertaken. We want to look at the issue of the sexual offences court and a well-functioning resource sexual offences court as a suggestion for a good way forward. Quality court staff, court preparation, psychosocial support. We want to look a little bit at the Tutela care centres and also looking at local multi-sectoral collaboration. We want you to notice that what we are saying is that we recognize infrastructure, the physical infrastructure of the buildings are important, but actually for us human resources is also really, really important that we would like the department to focus some attention on. So, to look at the sexual offences court, our Judicial Commissioner members were very pleased when what we are calling sexual offences court bill came out and participated quite vigorously in making submissions. And we want to recognize this is a really, really important move in terms of just putting a legal framework for the court safeguarding the these courts' existence. These courts offer really good models. We recently had visitors from India who work around sexual offenders in India visit here, and we took them to visit the Weinberg court, and they were really very much impressed. They don't have anything like that in India in terms of looking and dedicated service within the court system for survivors. And as you know, India and South Africa have been compared as the rape capitals of the world. And they looked at this model and took it back to discuss, you know, with their justice system as well. So a really good way to increase experience, to increase proper services to survivors, the sexual offences court offers us that. However, the Shamisa members had concerns around the Act, and we made submissions in this regard as well, that we didn't think that the Act went far enough, and that we were concerned that the Act didn't cover around provisioning, that the Act does not provide direction for the rollout of the courts, and the Act does not include minimum standards for resourcing and practice within the courts. We do know, however, that the Act makes provisions for regulations and that the Ministry to establish regulations, and that has started. However, we're not sure whether civil society and the public could comment and input and might have really valuable insight to add to those regulations at this point. We're not sure of that. We wanted to very quickly, I'm not sure if the committee had a chance to engage with the MAPSO report, but this is another important development for the Sexual Offences Court. And we know that it's not a policy document, but it was a really, really thorough investigation into what will it take to make the Sexual Offences Court run well. And these recommendations were really almost to the T what Shumisa members felt and had made submissions prior regarding what they felt would result in a really well-functioning Sexual Offences Court. So we again want to ask around a question from the Shukumisa members, will the MAPSO standards be included in the regulation? We are not sure about that, and we'd really like to know from the department as well. So just this, again, the report was very detailed and rigorous, and it deals with issues like infrastructure, it deals with issues like staff, it looked at training, victim support, and data collection. And we wanted to just draw your attention, especially to that highlighted section on the slide around staffing, which the MAPSO report determines two dedicated prosecutors assigned to each sexual offences court. And that alone, not even looking at all the other requirements, has real serious implications around resourcing. And we would like, and we know that if the department doesn't apply mind to the issue of resourcing, that the sexual offences court is not doing too well.
So again, we see some different numbers in different reports, but the official report from the department, the annual report, indicates that they currently have completed 19 sexual offences courts. The annual performance report indicates that they've finalized 21 courts. So either way, there's quite a number of courts that have been set up. But we want to note that most of the courts, and the reports are quite clear about this as well, the courts that have been established now since the implementation of the new law are courts that are already functioning and Special Offence Courts. And they're quite at pains going through the reports to say they're not requiring additional resources to get those courts up and running because they're already up and running. The important thing to note, if you look at the recent, on page 71, the recent department's annual, I keep getting this wrong, annual progress report on sexual offences, there's no dedicated budget for re-establishing sexual offences courts. And when I looked at the figures on that same report on page 61, they're saying per court, the human resources cost is between 2.2 million per year up to 2.5 progressively as the years increase. So that is a big cost. And our big concern is something that we saw in a period in the past where we had what are called sexual offence courts. And the clients of the organisation would go to these courts expecting a better treatment and not receiving better treatment. Having a prosecutor who was inexperienced, hadn't been properly trained, a magistrate that wasn't well conversant with the new laws and the practices. So the danger is if we have courts that are a name on the door, but they're not actually functioning as such. And the heart of the good functioning of the courts is, in our opinion, the staff at those courts. More than the CCTV system, more than waiting rooms, it's the people in the room. So we certainly would like to know how this plan to realize 57 courts by the March 2016 is going to be done under the current resourcing. I wanted to hear read some of the experiences of survivors. The first thing to note, one of the biggest issues is that we're not seeing this translation of the very good understanding at a national level of what is needed. We speak to the officials at a senior level in the department of the NPA, I think it is quite clear they understand what is needed to make a change. But we're not seeing that change on the ground. So it's incredibly variable. I'm talking here, in these quotes that are on the slide, there are quotes from children, and in one case, the court support worker, through the RAPCAN research, talking about their experiences, and they all show that in those cases, the law wasn't applied properly. These are sexual offence courts across the Western Cape in urban and peri-urban areas. So we're not talking about courts that have never heard of a sexual offence. These are specialised courts. In the first, you've got a child talking about how painful it was to see the accused because of her fear that he would kill her. Now the question is, why was that child in a courtroom and why was the CCTV system not being used? That is clear in the law that it needs to be used, not automatically, but in most cases. The next quote is a child talking about the fact that when they were in the court testifying, there's a different child also testifying in the court and not through CCTV, in spite of the provisions. There the child is saying there were people walking in and out of the court all the damn time, and that has an impact on me because I can see they're looking at me like funny. They're thinking about me. They're wondering about my case. So it's having an emotional impact. Again, the law says that in sexual offences, the public can be kept out of the court. And why then was that not applied in this case? And then lastly, you've got a case where the court support worker is explaining about a particular prosecutor that they're not explaining to the child why the case, or the family, why the case is being postponed. The directives for the National Prosecuting Authority require that kind of explanation. So there's a great discrepancy in the way that the law is being applied. Certainly lots of differences in attitude. And unfortunately, the Shukumisa members collectively, and we've discussed this at length, is that over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen it get worse from some gains that have previously been made. The first quote, the child is talking about a good experience of a prosecutor who was very respectful and provided support. And we really do want to recognize there are brilliant people in the system. We don't want our presentation to imply that we don't see those or recognize those. But then you've got three quotes following, which indicates the fact that the attitudes of the staff are often quite formal, quite functional. So you've got an adult prosecutor who's skilled in law, who's interrogating a child before the trial, and actually frightening the child, telling the child they're lying. The prosecutor is harsh, and so forth. So lots and lots of reports, and we get this from different members. The postponement issue, we do recognize that I was doing this work from 1996. I started working with RAP members, and at that stage, we're talking about turnaround times for cases between 3 and 5 years. So we absolutely do see an improvement in that because it's more frequent we see cases being turned around in a single year or 2 years. But at the same time, the postponements are coming up time and again from survivors as being a reason why I want to withdraw cases. So children being kept out of school, adults being kept out of work, not being able to afford it.
we've found a good explanation, good communication before. If there's a possibility of a postponement, is a way to avoid this. So you tell people before the day, his lawyer actually said he's going to come and ask for a postponement tomorrow, so we think you can stay home. And it works quite well. And then finally, the investment by the department into the waiting rooms at the courts has had a hugely positive impact on the experience of the complainants as they go to court and wait. That not being sitting in a hallway opposite the accused and their supporters makes a difference in how ready people feel to testify. But the problem is the court buildings. The court buildings through which you have to walk to get to the waiting room, to get to the court, to go to the toilet during the lunch break. We're finding complaints, and we've got this also from adult complainants, as well as children, are absolutely frightened by it. And I've been one quote I want to read, and it speaks a little bit to withdrawal issues. When you see that person that did something to you, you change your mind, and then you don't want to go further. Not that you are lying, but because you're scared of what can happen outside. My granny always tried to calm me, but I get so worked up because I know I go there and I see that man. It's a big thing, and we hear this through our clients often. They say that they made it up to get out of the system because they're not feeling safe in the system. The department's implementation report also speaks to this issue. They raise the question of whether the sexual offence court designation applies to a courtroom or the court building. And we really are struggling with the department, not just in space, but actually in prioritizing space in courts for these witnesses over other role players. And of course, public works, the extent to which they're coming to party. But I wanted to say here again that the value of people in this issue can't be underestimated. Because when you've got a team of people that recognize this problem, working in a court, they can't change buildings, they make a way to protect those complainants by finding extra door they can come in or walking through them. So your quality of staff really makes a difference. Thank you.
We're just going to go through. We have. Yes, like 3 minutes? 3 minutes? Thank you all for affording us the extra time. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Tutadilla case centers, except to say that, again, like the Sexual Offences Court, a very good model, considered a best practice model across the world again. Our visit from India, again, very impressed with it, that we have one-stop centers, something they don't have as well. And it's really a good model to try and, mediate some of the trauma that survivors experience in the criminal justice system. But again, the performance of the Tutadilla care centers are very erratic. If a survivor walks into Tutadilla care center A compared to a one walking into Tutadilla care center B, her experiences will be very, very different. Again, speaking to the issues of staffing and speaking to the issues of intersectoral collaboration, because the Tutadilla care centers is a model that incorporates the Department of Justice, NPA, SAS, Department of Health, and we know typically, even on national level, those intersectoral collaborations are tough, but particularly on local level, in those intersectoral centers, that there are members that told us that those intersectoral collaborations include, with civil society organizations as well, have been really difficult. I think I'll leave that. No problem.
Services that are offered by the NPA. But there are concerns that those are generalist services and not specialized, and that means that sometimes greater harm is done because the people are working with trauma and with children who are traumatized who don't have an understanding of those issues. So there's some serious dangers. There is also court preparation that is funded through DSD and international donors, and that is, tends to be specialized court preparation. Could lift some of the cost burden off the NPA if it's provided through DSD. So we've noted this recommendation in terms of the MUNSO standards in the regulations. We are questioning what the selection criteria are for the people working in the sexual offences courts. How are we making sure we're getting people with the right kind of the right attitude? And then more importantly, what are the systems and the mechanisms for management and monitoring at local level to ensure the local experience or the local value is the same as national value? Training, I'll leave out. Role of CSO, I think we've discussed. I do want to just say that we noted that the Intersectoral Committee are looking at co-opting civil society to it. We'd like to know how that's being done, in what kind of representative way, because in the past where civil society being part of a process was the Foundation for Human Rights, which is a big funding organization and not actually an organization of providing services in the country. And lastly, I want to really talk to resourcing and say that our two main analyses of the situation is that the priorities aren't translated into budgets. The money that's being spent on PCCs, on SOCs, is often coming from donor funds, not coming essentially out of the department's budget, and it's reported as such. So we're wondering if this is such an issue in the country, why are we not seeing it embedded in the department budget as opposed to some add-on that's done by UNICEF or the UN and a few others that the case is. I'm in a rush.
No, don't apologize. You are doing very good work because I don't think that the honorable members will have time to focus as closely on those matters as you do. Similarly, as partners, you have the challenge of values. You will be able to go down to do the work at hand. So I think to us you are very important. You are doing very good work. And that's why I give you time. Don't want to lose an outside and through stone. You come and tell us what you think should be done when it's not done. Thank you very much. You know, I was thinking that we should get the other presentation and then because these things are interrelated. Can we go the route? Rafkan? I mean, I'm sorry, the women's center, yes.
Good morning, honourable members. Thank you very much, Chair, and also good morning to the officials from the department. The Women's Legal Centre really welcomes and thanks the committee for this opportunity to make submission, specifically on the 2013-2014 annual report of the department.
The members want to know you by name, not
Fair enough, Chair. My name is Tanya Borman, and I am an attorney at the Women's Legal Centre, and I am specifically responsible for the gender-based violence portfolio at the centre, which is one of five different focus areas relating to the rights of women that the centre works on. In this brief submission, we will highlight, as per the invitation of the committee, the following considerations relevant to the annual report. Firstly, some measures that have been put in place in the 2013-14 annual report to deal with sexual offences. We also look at some further considerations in relation to gender-based violence and progress relating to the improvement of the maintenance system in this particular financial year. And then maybe just by way of introduction to the Women's Legal Centre, for those members who don't know much about us, we are a non-governmental organisation and our core objective is to advance and protect the human rights of all women in South Africa. A group of women lawyers found us in 1999, and in 2014 we are celebrating our 15th year of existence. Now, WLC has participated in an extensive number of precedent-setting cases that have extended women's human rights in relation to gender-based violence, health, property rights, access to land and housing, and resources within relationships. And our litigation in this regard is supported by advocacy, which of course includes making submissions to portfolio committees such as yourselves. In terms of promoting access to justice for women and girls, we also provide free legal advice to women on a daily basis, and we do this by making available our attorneys and paralegals to attend to women who visit our offices, who call our offices, or to send us legal queries via email. And we are primarily based in Cape Town, but we also have offices in Khayelitsha and in Johannesburg. We also provide legal support to a range of organizations that seek to protect women's rights, and I should perhaps at this stage indicate that the Women's Legal Center is also a member of the Shukamisa campaign, and where our submissions overlap today, I will not repeat the good work that my colleagues have already done this morning. I wish to start off with some general comments on the annual report. Firstly, we would like to note that we're encouraged, very encouraged, by the Department's action and investment in some areas to deal with gender-based violence, which was highlighted by President Zuma in his State of the Nation address as one of the core challenges facing our country at this point. But we are somewhat concerned that the annual report does not appear to sufficiently focus on gender-based violence as a major concern challenging the country and the resulting challenges that women and girls are facing and acting just as a result. The establishment of court infrastructure, as my colleagues have mentioned, is certainly one major step in achieving improved access to justice. But research has shown us that women and girls often abandon their pursuit to accessing justice because the system is failing them. And this particular system is far more than infrastructure and includes efficiency, things such as spending time waiting at court, access to adequate and accurate information, and being assisted in a manner and in a language that clients can understand. It would therefore have been useful to get a sense of how the department engages with its clients and its end users of courts, and how they measure the progress in relation to development and new programs and systems implemented with regard to the effective access of justice for women and girls in South Africa. And in this regard, we are concerned that some of the targets set by the department appear to be primarily process-orientated and a little bit quantitative, as opposed to drawing on qualitative client and end-user experiences. And the targets at times have been quite low in the annual report. So in dealing with sexual offences in the 2013 and 2014 annual report of the department, I do not propose to go over the issue of sexual offences court conviction rate or to develop death sentences again, because I think my colleagues have already done a pretty good job of that. So instead, I propose that we move on to some of the other aspects as they relate to gender-based violence and as they appear in the annual report. I'd like to speak to you about domestic violence and harassment. In a recent submission to the committee, specifically on the Legal Aid Bill, the Women's Legal Centre indicated some of the challenges faced by women when applying for protection orders in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, and the domestic violence situation in the country was identified as one of the most frequent reasons why women approach the Women's Legal Centre for advice and assistance. Significantly in the financial year under report, the new Protection from Harassment Act also became fully operational. And this act solved a very crucial service delivery gap by creating a civil remedy for those women and girls who are victims of harassment where they are not in a domestic relationship with their harasser. And we really wish to congratulate the department on the operationalization of this particular piece of legislation. However, according to the annual report, progress in relation to domestic violence prevention and services appears to be quite limited. And aside from Justice College training on the subject of domestic violence, there is no further indication of the achievements and challenges faced by domestic violence courts or any significant investment in improving services. Likewise, there is no detail provided as to the success and challenges in the implementation of the new Protection from Harassment Act, aside from an indication that numerous victims are making use of it. And we are also aware that long after this new act was implemented, very few court officials had actually been trained on how to implement this act. And we are also concerned that the same overworked and under-resourced services and staff that have to deal with domestic violence interdicts are now also the ones dealing with the new Protection from Harassment interdicts. And research and experience has again shown that these services are already severely pressured and that this can result in poor service delivery. We wish to point out that these pieces of legislation play a very crucial role in providing assistance and protection for victims of gender-based violence. And it is critical to indicate implementation successes or failures to enable us to have proper planning in future and to plan what sort of improvements need to be made in the future. Research that was conducted by the Tuanang Legal Advocacy Centre in 2012 on accessing protection orders in courts in Gauteng specifically revealed that women who sought protection orders had very different experiences, and unfortunately most of them were negative, which again emphasises the need to really reflect on implementation challenges and successes. This research indicates that applicants were at times treated with disrespect, yelled at, spoken to harshly when asking court officials for information on how to apply for a protecting order or what to expect going forward through the system. And other practical challenges highlighted in the research include some of the following. Thirdly, approximately 70% of applicants for protection orders did not actually have English as their first language, and yet the application forms are not provided in any other language besides English. And this situation was compounded by the fact that a large number of applicants had to complete the forms on their own, and in some cases they asked for assistance from a security guard at court, which I think we can all agree is not the optimal situation. Secondly, applying for protection orders is time-consuming. It's proven to be quite a time-consuming process. Only 23% of the applicants that form part of this research spent less than an hour in court, and the remainder of those had to wait between 2 and 6 hours or more for assistance. And at one of the courts that formed part of this research project, the delays were so significant that some people left the court before they were able to be assisted because they could no longer afford to wait. Applicants were also not always guaranteed to receive assistance on the same day, and this was often dependent on the availability of magistrates. So there is definitely a resource issue that needs to be addressed. However, at one of the courts, the clerk also refused to assist applicants beyond a particular time, and we've also heard from our clients at times that domestic violence courts only will take a certain number of applications within a particular day, even though it is nowhere stipulated in the Domestic Violence Act that this should be the practice. Waiting period between applying for an interim protection order and returning to court for the final protection order, that the time in between those two sort of landmarks in the process varied widely across courts, and some from as little as 2 weeks between the two, while other courts had a waiting time for the final protection order that was up to 6 weeks or even longer. For those women who are employed, of course, and this is 65% sample that formed part of this research project, taking time off from work to go to court was challenging. It also has financial implications where a person has to make use of the annual leave in order to attend at court. And this was further exacerbated by delay, needing to again return to court on multiple occasions. And time delays also held significant implications for those needing protection from abuse. Court clerks did not always fulfill their duties as prescribed by the Domestic Violence Act, inclusive of not always providing applicants with sufficient information, not only in relation to the application form itself, but really what to expect going forward through the system and what to expect following the court's granting the interim protection order, as well as the difference between an interim protection order and a final protection order. Unsuccessful applicants were not always provided with reasons for not being granted a protection order, and whilst this may seem like a small issue in a process sense, it makes all difference to the individual client that really feels that she needs protection from the system. Negative attitudes and the lack of sensitivity to needs was also raised by applicants in this research as concerned their interaction with the police, but as well as at a court level. So it is really in light of these experiences that we would urge the department to provide more feedback in its annual report on the state of domestic violence court services, as well as the implementation of the very critical Protection from Harassment Act in future reports, as the latter act in particular is filling what used to be quite a significant gap in our law, and we need to be able to see how we're doing. I'd like to speak briefly to you about training. Whilst training in respect of governance and management systems seems to have proceeded apace in the financial year under review, there is very little indication of training provided on gender issues and gender sensitivity in general. And whilst it is very gratifying to know that the Justice College provided training in relation to maintenance, domestic violence and sexual offences, there is still no training taking place in relation to these broader gender issues. Now, such training would really allow officials in our justice system and court system to respond sensitively not only to women, but also to persons who are gender non-conforming or not heterosexual. And the need for this training is really apparent to the Women's Legal Centre in the types of queries that we receive, especially in relation to the implementation of the Sexual Offences Act, as well as the Domestic Violence Act. It sees that personal prejudices still intrude on the way in which clients are being served, and this can result in secondary traumatization and really a loss of faith in the justice system to assist and respond compassionately and professionally to all victims, regardless of their personal circumstances. And there still is a great need for sensitization training to facilitate the best and least traumatizing treatment of clients and victims as they come into contact with officials in the criminal justice system and even the civil court system. I'd like to speak to you then about the national task team that's been set up by the department to deal with violence against members of the LGBTI community. The Women's Legal Centre is really very pleased to note that the national task team appears to have made some progress in the financial year under review, but it is a cause for concern that the task team was established in May of 2011 and only managed to finalise the terms of reference in 2013-14 financial year. We are of the view that the task team's work must progress much faster than what is currently the case. And while it is important to finalise outstanding cases of these incidents of violence currently in the criminal justice system, it would also be useful to have further information on the broader activities of the task team and some indication of the impact that these activities are having on the South African community to date. We really believe the task team as a multi-sectoral and interdepartmental team can play a crucial role in the transformation of our society when it comes to issues relating to LGBTI community. And we really urge the task team to make itself far more visible and to conduct its activities in a more urgent and more robust way. We also note that a hate speech bill is being reported as being in progress, and this legislation would really be an important step towards curbing hate crime, racially and otherwise motivated, and we really look forward to public consultations on this piece of legislation in what we hope will be the very near future. There's also talk of the Project 107 on adult sex work in the annual report, and we really would like to indicate how pleased we are with the finalization of this research relating to Project 107. We have some concern in relation to the progress of this specific project. First of all, delay in issuing discussion paper in preparation for a report and draft legislation in this regard. This particular process commenced in 2009, and to date the report is still outstanding. And the report on the 2009 discussion paper was due to have been released first in 2011, then in 2012, and then imminently, but to date that report remains outstanding. Secondly, the Women's Legal Centre, SISOKE, and the Sex Worker Education Advocacy Task Force, better known as SWET, has submitted a Promotion of Access to Information Act application to the department in January of 2013. And this was specifically for access to some of the substantive submissions that are made in relation to this particular report. And to date, we have unfortunately not had a satisfactory response to our application. And in this regard, we really want to emphasize that the finalization of Project 107 is vital. And we hope that the process involved in Project 107 will be prioritized and fast-tracked in the future. The patterns of abuse that adult female sex workers experience are the direct result of their criminalized status, and this increases their vulnerability to violence exponentially. And the current legal framework reinforces sex workers to the margins of South African society, where they are easy targets for abuse at the hands of both police officers and clients. And the only remedy is to change the way in which sex work and the industry of sex work in South Africa is viewed under the law and by the institutions responsible for the administration of our law. I now turn to some of the progress in improving the maintenance system as outlined in the annual report. Many women seeking advice in relation to accessing and enforcing their right to maintenance have approached the Women's Legal Centre for advice over the years, and it is with these clients and their experiences in mind as we make the following comments in relation to what we see in the annual report. Firstly, we would really like to take this opportunity to commend the department on introducing the system of electronic funds transfers, or EFT, for maintenance payments, and secondly, in progressively implementing that system. Since the inception of the payments by EFT, there has been a remarkable decrease in complaints from beneficiaries in relation to payments received, and the system has improved the lives of women in that they no longer have to take aside time to approach the courts to receive their maintenance payments. One of the reasons women elected to have their payments made through the department via EFT rather than receiving payments directly from respondents is to ensure prima facie evidence in the event that the respondent or the person responsible for making those payments defaults in those payments. And the record-keeping function of the system really assists with the execution of a re-maintenance process. We do have some concerns regarding the access and quality of services related to maintenance, however. First, I'd like to speak about locating respondents and defaulters. Now, women often have great difficulties in locating respondents in maintenance cases for various reasons. Sometimes the relationship between the complainant and the respondent has deteriorated to the extent that they simply have no contact with each other, amongst other things. But women who are uncertain of the whereabouts of respondents or who simply don't have the details of the respondents approach the courts for assistance. We have had reports that these women are told that the maintenance court will be unable to assist until complainant herself obtains details of the respondent's whereabouts. And this is of some concern because it appears that women are not being informed by the clerks of the court of full extent of the services that are provided by maintenance officers and maintenance investigators. Women are often turned away then with no assistance or guidance from the maintenance courts and are left feeling completely helpless and often disillusioned with the ability of the maintenance system to assist them. The second challenge that we're hearing about from our clients is concealment of accurate financial information. And the Women's Legal Centre has received complaints from women that respondents actually failed to submit his or her correct financial information to the courts, or alternatively provide false information on what that particular respondent actually earns. And in our experience, the maintenance officers and maintenance investigators themselves have great difficulty in verifying whether the information provided by the respondent is accurate, especially if that respondent is self-employed, which is often the case, or employed by family members or friends who will then assist that respondent in concealing the correct and accurate information. This causes a significant delay and obstructs the administration of justice, and in time infringes on children's rights to be properly maintained, as the Act envisages. We believe that more resources then could have been allocated for the training and resourcing of maintenance investigators. In the maintenance turnaround project, we note under milestones and achievements that only one training session on the tracing of defaulters was conducted. And the tracing of defaulters and responders is a much needed skill for both the officers, maintenance officers, as well as the maintenance investigators. Such training must occur more frequently and should be extended to include maintenance officers and not be limited to the investigators, because the role of maintenance officers cannot, in the system and the assistance they can provide to complainants cannot be underestimated. A third challenge that our clients are facing is the service of process. Now, the service of process is a further area, and it is common knowledge that a proper service of documents is really a mandatory, a very important part of any legal process. And failure to conduct proper service can lead to delays, and it can potentially derail completely any legal process. And our clients have experienced the consequences of no service, delayed service, or improper service of legal documents to the parties by the maintenance system. This often leads to matters being postponed and being delayed unduly. Overall, then, we are of the view that the maintenance turnaround project is perhaps too process-orientated. And while improvement in the process is certainly necessary, as we've seen with the EFT system, the quality of services is perhaps not being sufficiently assessed from the end user perspective, leaving doubt as to whether the turnaround project is truly responsive to the lived realities of the clients and the women who so desperately need assistance on the system. In conclusion, we would just like to emphasize again the importance of the constitutional responsibility of the state when it comes to service delivery, and that includes respecting, protecting and promoting and fulfilling the rights of citizens set up in the Bill of Rights and to deliver services to the citizenry, which really are commensurate with their hopes and aspirations. And just by way of closure, we really would like to once again thank the committee for inviting us to make these submissions and also for allowing us time to make oral submissions in the program today. I thank you.
Because I don't think the department or the MPs here can render the valuable services that you are rendering. But also, most of the things that you say, the department has to respond. So I'm not sure whether we should really spend more time engaging with you, rather than unless we want to clarify, but then wait for the department to respond. I think it's also after as a different view.
I just want to commend the NGOs and Civil Society for their excellent reports. It's very, very helpful to us, and I know it will give the department a lot to respond to as well. I think, you know, if one looks at the lack of successful prosecution that is highlighted in the reports, and you take that when you start at 60,000 and end up at those percentages, and you bear in mind that only, I think it's 1 in 9 or 1 in 10, so 1 in 9 cases are actually reported. So the situation is far worse, and you've even given a positive spin to it, but it's actually far worse. And so when we look at, and I'm very pleased that India came to Weinberg and they saw what the work is doing there, we should go, we need to go. We need to go out and study to it. We need to go look at Weinberg, where the best practice, and then we need to go to Mpumalanga and go and see why is it 0.8%, and take 1 in 10 reported that's actually 0.08%. And we need to find out why in the rural areas is it such a discrepancy. And we need, when we both, I've been on study tours in the past, but we need to have civil society members, the caregivers, go with us. So that we don't hear the nice picture that what early community coming, you actually hear from the people on the ground that this is what happened yesterday. I find these quotes very helpful from children, because it's absolutely, it shouldn't be happening. So, Chair, there's a lot of good things here, and I know, DG, you responded, and there are positive aspects here as well, not all negative, really. There are some positive aspects here as well. But I just wanted to highlight that one aspect. And another thing we need to look at is, because our prosecution levels are so low, why are we prosecuting, or why are we bringing children to court to prosecute on rape cases? Shouldn't the prosecutors rather look at statutory rape and where they can at least get a conviction relatively easily, where the issue of consent, the issue of evidence is not so important? And then an issue which we have spoken about here is the issue of minimum sentences. Now, I am fully supportive of minimum sentences. The Constitutional Court has raised particularly for sexual offences. I'd like a short comment from civil society on the need for minimum sentences when it comes to sexual offences, because there's a sentiment here in the committee that the prisons are too full and it's because of minimum sentences, and we've got to relook at that legislation. And we need to balance that view with what our vulnerable women are experiencing, particularly when it comes to the low conviction rates that we are having. This is a pandemic in society, and we need to, as portfolio committee members, step up to the plate and help our vulnerable women and children. Thank you, Chair.
I think I would like to commend the presentation, well researched, and the good work done by the organizations. And I was also very like the manner in which they were presenting those two minutes, so it was quite interesting. But I think in the main, I want us to look at integration. To what extent can you deal with the issues of integration? Because my concern is, before we arrive at the conviction part, but there are a lot of other issues that we may have to concentrate on, and if we do, we may deal with this matter. Integration in terms of looking at the police, justice as we are, but in the main, the social services, Department of Education, at the center of the human settlement. Because when he took over office, His Excellency President Zuma started a new department and said it's human settlement, moving away from what we used to call housing. So human settlement in this context, it means we need now to cater for all needs that are placed in societies, from economic and so on, because these children, where they're brought up, does play a particular role, and these people who are abusing these children, the situation where they are human settled plays a very critical role, and it may just assist in terms of this matter that you are faced with, and also look at the issues of the alternative dispute resolutions, because those are some of the instruments that I think we need to look at. Because whilst we're crying that the convictions are more, convictions are less, because half of the cases will get conviction, half out the run. But even to imagine a situation where all these people are convicted, they're all in correctional service centers, then government must use our more money in terms of catering the people in the correctional service centers. So I think we need to invest more. And I would like to see these organizations concentrating on the investment on the issues, particularly of human settlement, because some of the places where these people are settled, they do this thing out of serious frustrations, not knowing what to do. There is lack of education. There is no facilities where children can play, and so on and so forth. So, particularly in the rural areas, here you mentioned Mpumalanga and so on. So I think we need to do that investigation, because now the African National Congress in its 5th conference addressed the issue that we need to deal with radical transformation. So we'll not deal with the transformation if we don't attack the issues. In the main, I think, human settlement, because if people are not properly settled, these disputes will come in a manner that would be uncontrollable. So I think that will be my contribution here, and I would appreciate maybe in the next financial year we see a lot of investment in terms of these issues that are social ills, that there are social ills done. Because if we have them, I think we'll do less.
But the level of education, people will know that. Because in other areas, there are people who don't know that they think that this country is in things like they even don't understand. They are not knowing their own original business. So now everyone wants to abuse this country and commit these crimes. And in other places, they think women are in need. And you must do everything to a woman. So I think education and the issue of human settlement are in the main that you must deal with, rather than to invest more on the conditions, because government does not have money to take people into community correction centers. So I think the next financial year, I'll be interested in following you, because I also heard that you're in the university there. I was wanting to see a lot of work done along those lines. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Jefferson. Just to thank both the Women's Legal Center and the community Los Angeles on Mesa for the presentation. Basically, I think your concern is right in terms of concern around peer performance indicators being violence against women. Maybe for the Department of Justice, we actually want to really know the extent to which this is actually taken into consideration. It will actually take us back to the crisis as to where the gender focal point is actually achieving this area of work. Because this actually borders from everything that's about gender mainstreaming within the department. It might be good at some stage to manage to get a full report from the gender focal point of the Department of Justice, and it will actually give answers to a number of questions that have been raised, be it potentially, be it issues of sex work that has actually just been mentioned by the Women's Legal Center, be it maintenance, because even from the committee, there's a number of issues that are actually expressed in terms of, for example, maintenance, to actually indicate concern around quantum attachments or forces, restriction of movement. It's quite a number of issues that we've been raising that will have to be taken into consideration, like, for example, the agenda focal points. And indeed, we'd be interested to get progress in line with your concern, Women's Legal Center, in relation to the CAP team that was established in 2011, with terms of reference from the established in 2015, maybe to look at what are the challenges, why is it really taking this long for things to happen. And you've actually also expressed, Shugumisa, you indicated the appreciation of establishment of the cause and continued existence of Tutuzela care centers, but you've actually questioned the whole issue of resourcing, which will go hand in hand with the financial reports that we'll deal with when the department is actually presenting, but we need to take into consideration that we are busy head-hunting. So the head-hunting actually affects everything across the board. So it might be the answer that you may be getting soon. I'm not sure. We will hear when the department actually presents. And indeed, there is also concern that still goes to gender focal point. Monitoring as to why cases are withdrawn, gender-based violence cases are withdrawn, because there is a history of really having a lot of cases being withdrawn, and that could be extension of abuse, and we just need to be careful that in the area we manage to get the area properly streamlined. Shubhita, you said something that is also concerning. To say that police are discouraging victims from reporting for them to meet the targets. I think this is quite a heavy statement to make. And I don't know whether it's accompanied by information and data. And of course, it's something that doesn't belong to this portfolio committee, because then it just goes to the police portfolio committee. My suggestion would be if you make a statement of this data for it to be really accompanied with actual information that signifies the public. Thanks.
Let's give them the benefits of doubt and session every now and then. I wanted to comment to say there is law in society. Now, the training of our lawyers is taught legal rules and some foreign legal philosophy, but they are not taught anything about the society which they live. So you have lawyers who don't understand the society that they are serving. You have lawyers who don't know the language of the majority of the people. That's why
people who return to security officers to help them write statements. And do you think the statement written by security officers can stand the test in court? Now, the question would be, isn't the problem lying somewhere? That our universities don't produce the type of lawyers that can help society. The lawyers don't know the language of the people. The lawyers don't know the understand the society, and they will sit here and say, department, why are convictions low? How will they get that right unless the legal, the law degrees are dealt with? You know, when some of us came to home, Africans was compulsory, English was compulsory, Latin was compulsory. Why can't we say now that you can't get a law degree unless you know at least one indigenous African language? And we say you can't get all now unless you have done criminology or sociology, because those things are part of the package. And also what the Honorable Shast was raising, you take another Wonga, you take small children from informal settlements to court for rape. Those kids, where they live, that could even be sports. They are sitting there, they have nowhere to play, and then they start playing with things that they see at night because of the type of human settlements that are there. So we may actually be dealing with the social problems, not the legal problems, and then putting wrong questions to the department. And also the question of training. The suggestions of training are things that then the personnel of this department actually should go to school. We disclose the departments for a while, send them to schools, because we have more than 30 universities. What are these universities doing? If people still require training when they are required, it is then completed. So there must be a problem somewhere. There's this question of funding. You made a reference to the Foundation for Human Rights, and you were even questioning, why should we get money from UNICEF? The department is not providing enough. Do we know how much money comes into that foundation? What are the criteria for its distribution? Maybe we need to get more information. Also, where the money is directed to, because you see, there was a very useful development in this country of public interest law, where you have community-based advice centers with paralegals that are operating within the communities, who speak the languages in the communities. But now, if we are going to have all same structures being in the cities, and then the money goes to the cities, that means the resources will also be accessible to the people that need the resources most. I hope we'll have time to hear more, but I thought for now, I want to give that you will wait for the presentation of the department, and I don't think there's any reason why you cannot participate in the discussion at that stage, so that we don't waste time now. We move on, and then we'll give you space to attend. But the point one seeks to make is that I think our problems really come from society, not from the department, so on. And also maybe the type of training. So at appropriate time, we may need to discuss about legal qualifications in this country, because I don't think that is useful.
This is just one last point, maybe targeted to the response probably from Lampkin, to say that you indicated right at the beginning that you're going to look at the rights of women and children, but to a large extent the report was mostly based on women and abuse of women, but children of course when it comes to sexual abuses. But what I need to know is whether you're still following in general issues of child protection, development and survival, and to what extent are you still interested in the National Program of Action for Children of South Africa, whether that is being monitored?
Thanks for the presentation. Chairman Sangam, I'm a bit concerned because the organizations have offices, mostly.
There's tea outside, and there's permanent lift to set up. So those who want tea can pick up tea and come back, and the department can start setting up.
Of course, offices like a woman legal center have offices in only two provinces, which is Western Cape and Gauteng. And women in rural areas are in the majority. And apparently, from both of you, you don't have any offices in rural provinces, such as Limpopo, Gauteng, and Eastern Cape. Then, and Mpumalanga. Thank you. What's this book? So, how then can we say this is a true reflection of views of majority of women in relation to the department's annual report? Is it not time that maybe you also spread your wings to rural provinces? On the issue of languages, Honorable Chairperson has touched on it, but especially when coming to issues, filling in of domestic violence form. That is really very, very critical. And also issue of proactivity in terms of education programs in promoting human rights, specifically in rural areas. I know NPA has got such a program on GBV, but yourselves, and also partnerships with progressive organizations such as Moral Regeneration Movement and other organizations which promote values to address such social ills as mentioned by Honorable Bongo here. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah, indeed, if you are operating only in two provinces and you don't have enough resources, it still raises the question, what is happening to the resources that the Foundation for Human Rights has? Maybe we should get them here to come and tell them, tell us how they are utilizing those resources, how they. Yeah. Yeah, correction, yes.
Thank you, Jefferson. Just to know that the Sugar Lisa campaign has 45 members across the country. In our four strongest provinces are the Western Cape and Gauteng, but we have members of strong representation from KZN and Eastern Cape, and then smaller representation from Limpopo, and we have one member in the Northern Cape, and that mentorship is growing at the moment. So the Sugar Lisa campaign, unlike the Women's Legal Center, we are not an organization. We are a network of a range of different organizations across the country. So when we speak about our members' input, we do specifically speak and include voices from rural areas.
Thank you very much for that. And I guess you will provide us more information because we may be talking because we don't know.
Thank you, Chair. I just also wanted to perhaps put the Honourable Member's mind at ease with regards to the representation and the submissions of the Women's Legal Centre. Even though we are headquartered in Cape Town and we have a satellite office in Johannesburg and one in Khayelitsha, our work takes place on a national level. We litigate in all nine provinces of the country, and our training and advocacy programs, we go where we are needed. And so it's not only limited to the Cape Town Metro or to the Johannesburg Metro by any means. Thank you.
Don't feel prosecuted. We just want to hear from you.
they are not black. Thank you.
always sends apologies away. We always can account for your whereabouts. So you're welcome. Gigi, we are in your good hands.
Thank you very much, Chadison. We have a team made up of, I think they will just have to say who they are, because I'm struggling to turn my neck, starting with the Office of the Chief Justice.
Thank you, Chadison. I'm Kazi Kuter, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the OCJ.
I'm E.T. Malema from the Justice Department.
My name is Gigi. I'm the Chief Operations Officer at the Department of Justice and Constitutional Problems.
Gigi, I'm Lorraine Rizal, the Chief of the Department of Justice.
My name is Lebo Mphahlele Ntsasa. I'm the Chief Director for Strategy Monitoring and Evaluation at the UOG.
And then Chair Nkululeko Sindlane in the Office of the Director General. Our presentation is relatively long term, but what we will try and do, given some of the questions that have already been raised, either arising of the presentation of the Auditor General in the morning or from the presentations of the stakeholders, where we feel that it's in that area that we wish to respond, we will then use the presentation and then amplify some of the questions that have been raised. We may not be able to cover every question that was raised earlier, but when we finish, we may then attempt to address the balance of the questions that we may not have covered. If the House allows, we will move on those bases. Thank you very much, Chairperson. The annual report for 2013-2014 financial year speaks in part to the voted funds that are allocated through the approval of this Honourable House, and as well as some funds that we receive from the donors, as well as funding that we receive through the CARA, which is the Criminal Assets Recovery Account, arising out of the processes of the POCA Act. Basically, we will deal with, in part, some of the key policy as well as legislation and related issues. We will start with the implementation of the Superior Court Act of 2013, which was approved recently. And we say recently because it was in the making for a very long time. Since the approval of the Act, we commenced in earnest with the work to assist the Office of the Chief Justice, even though that work had commenced prior to the Act being approved in preparation for the approval of the Act. What we have since done is that we, in part, have to look at our own organization as the Department of Justice and ensure that we have capacity and ensure that all the work that must be done by the Office of the Chief Justice is actually ring-fenced, including the financial resources as well as the budget, as well as the human resources associated with that. I might also add, Chairperson, that in this work we were given a very specific policy guidance that the physical infrastructure, such as the physical buildings, are not going to be split according to the Department of Justice as well as the Office of the Chief Justice. The Department of Justice as a policy department will continue to be responsible for infrastructure to the Office of the Chief Justice. Insofar as the presentation is concerned, therefore, there are superior courts which are to be transferred to the Chief Justice. I might add that on the 1st of October, that process has happened. Now, the Honourable House may ask, why did we choose mid-year to do this actual physical transfer? We did that
not because we were not mindful of the risks associated with moving its media, but we wanted to use the balance of the period between October and March 2015 to ensure that we tidy up whatever issues that may arise with physical transfer of staff to the Office of the Chief Justice, but effectively from the 1st of October. We have been very mindful of the reporting responsibilities. We are very nervous, and I'm sure the Office of the Chief Justice is as nervous, because if you break the relationship in here, obviously there may be things that may fall into the cracks. So our monitoring has got to be absolutely top-notch for us to ensure that we do not regress in the matters that we are dealing with. We do believe honestly that the Office of the Chief Justice will get its budget by the its vote by the 1st of April 2015, but we also consider that it will, as going forward, we will continue to have a very close working relationship, which will assist us to correct whatever needs correcting between now and until the office is fully fledged and fully functional. We are starting this year, which was the year that has been, we started with looking at the blueprint of the transformation of lower courts, but that work will continue in earnest in the current financial year. We started that work because part of the provisions of the Superior Courts Act spoke to the responsibilities of the regional court presidents in relation to the lower courts. And therefore, it forced us, amongst others, to start working on developing the blueprint for the lower courts. I must also add that in the consultations that we have had with the lower courts, they have indicated a feeling of being left out as a result of not being included in the Superior Court, and therefore that forced the debate a lot sooner than we had originally anticipated. We also worked on the rationalization of lower courts in our own mind, as well as part of the plan, given the fact that the Superior Court Act had already been approved. You will recall that we had been reporting that we had started with this work, but we could not complete the work because it did depend as much as possible to the Superior Court Superior Court Act being finalized. So the finalization then gave rise to the rationalization of the lower court program. I must indicate it's a very exciting program, Chair. We would wish to come and brief the committee specifically on the rationalization project, because it is commencing on the 1st of December 2014 in two provinces, which is in Northwest as well as Gauteng. We worked quite aggressively on the transformation of state legal services. The Honourable House would recall that we presented here the policy framework. We've done additional work since then. Part of the thing that we have done, amongst others, has been to promote the amendments to the Attorneys Act, so that we can appoint the Solicitor General. We've worked administratively in ensuring that the position of the Solicitor General is evaluated. That process has been finalized. The position is now to be advertised, so that we can then have the Solicitor General hopefully at the beginning of the new financial year. Perhaps before I pass the slide, Chair, I must also indicate that there has been a lot of noise in the system about the overall performance of the state attorneys in the country, just generally. We want to assure this Honourable House that we are not blind to what is happening in the state attorneys. There is considerable work that is happening behind the scenes, and we know that the judiciary has been unhappy, and we are addressing the issues that the judiciary has raised as well as the general government insofar as the performance of the state attorney. So the Solicitor General, amongst others, would assist us with developing norms and standards for the work of the state attorney, in addition to other responsibilities that the Solicitor General will have. I must also add that we are not waiting. We've developed a whole range of instruments so long so that to enable the Solicitor General so that when he or she joins the department, he or she hits the ground running. The transformation of the judicial system has been a project that when we first introduced it in this Honourable House, it received very, very mixed responses. The biggest response was that we were trying to interfere in the work of the judiciary when we commenced with the project. I must indicate that right now I think those responses and the reactions are looking a lot different to what they were when the project started. We did a study through the Human Science Research Council in partnership with the University of Fort Hare, insofar as this work is concerned. The research methodologies were approved and the first document was introduced and I was produced in draft form. Obviously the project is not over, so it was a progress report and document. I do believe that it was presented to this Honourable House and the feedback that we received was that it was very well received. This year we've worked, in fact, during the year under review, we worked quite aggressively in amending the, in developing the insolvency policy because we did not have the insolvency policy since the inception of the legislation, even though the insolvency policy was required to be in place in terms of the legislation. However, when we were just about to get the policy approved in terms of our government processes, our stakeholders were not very pleased with some of the provisions of the policy on insolvency, and they took us to court on that on an interim basis. We have since addressed all the issues, and we are awaiting that the matter will be going to court. In fact, I think it is in court today as we speak, and we hope that we will be successful in this in that challenge. The Honourable House will know that the Legal Practice Bill has, well, the Legal Practice Act is now an act, and that a lot of work should happen behind the scenes to ensure that the act is actually implemented. Perhaps at this stage, I may, because we've seen some of the representations from some of the stakeholders, the act in its current form does not deal with the paralegals in its current form. We were consulted during the drafting of the Act, but towards the latter part of the drafting of the Act, I must also say that this was one of the legislation that took at least about 10 years to finalize. So at some point we needed to push quite hard to ensure that the legislation is approved. We took those representations to heart, but it was felt that at a particular point in time, we could not include them as part of the Legal Practice Act. So going forward, it's a new area that we will interact with because we do believe that paralegals are doing great work and they are assisting, among others, South Africans to have reach and access to the court system. The Criminal Law Forensic Procedures Amendment Act of 2018 was finalized during the period under review, and a lot of work has gone in preparation for implementation of the Act. Our department's critical responsibility, among others, is to ensure that obviously our officials, including the prosecution, are trained in the legislation first and foremost, but secondly, we have a responsibility in terms of the integrated justice system development to develop a system that will enable us to implement an electronic system that will enable us to implement the DNA Act. I must indicate that in partnership with SARS, we've had a number of iterations to prepare for such systems development, even though at this stage we do not have a system that is through the IJF project as yet. Amendments to the schedule to the Drug and Drug Trafficking Act of 1992 was done, and we want to appreciate Parliament for assisting us with this because at least for the past 10 years or so, our communities have been ravaged by drugs, but obviously in the recent past, we were trying specifically to address the problems associated with Nyawupe and Munga, which are seriously ravaging our young people, and we needed to address it through this legislation, and we are grateful, therefore, to this Honourable House. Work on the National Action Plan on Crimes Against Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender and Intersex Community has actually progressed quite heartily for me anyway. And that's because perhaps, Chair, I may say this, that there is a certain degree of subjectivity because I am part of the work. And I probably know some of the things that some of the colleagues who have spoken earlier may not have been as close to the process as possible. Let me then, Chair, if you allow me, deal with the issues that were raised earlier in terms of gender-based violence and the LGBTI community being included in the gender-based violence. It is true, Chair, that the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Development announced the setting up of this committee in 2011 March. It is also true that during the period of March to the period of now in 2014, we have had to find each other relationship-wise between ourselves and the stakeholders in dealing specifically with the issues affecting this community. And I must indicate that that process of finding each other took a lot longer than what we had anticipated. Even within the department, we have had to move this work from where it started originally to where it is because of some of the problems that were associated with relations as well as performance in this area of work. However, Chair, having set out all those difficulties, in 2013, in fact, starting in 2012, we started developing the governance documents and engaging the stakeholders better, communicating better, and ensuring that the National Prosecuting Authority, in terms of the cases that they are handling, we track where those cases are from a performance point of view, we track the reported cases in SAPS, and we develop a working relationship with SAPS, including the establishment of the Rapid Response Task Team. I must indicate that even though these the terms of reference for the National Task Team, the terms of reference for the Rapid Response Team, as well as the National Intervention Strategy were approved only during the year under review, there was work that was happening on the ground, even though it was not formalized because the terms of reference were not already approved. I must indicate, Chair, that perhaps if time allows in the calendar of this Honourable Committee, we would like to come and present specifically this strategy, the terms of reference, and the work that is actually happening on the ground in this area of work. It's one of the areas of work in the broader department where stakeholders are actively engaged, government departments are actively engaged, the National House for Traditional Leadership is actively engaged in this work, and in fact, in most areas, we are using the footprint of the National House for Traditional Leadership, supported obviously by the Department of Traditional Affairs, to reach those communities in rural areas. Now, Chair, the question was that was raised was, in spite of this, we continue to see the LGBTI community continue to suffer the rape and hate crimes committed against them. And I must say, Chair, that it is indeed true that we continue to see that happening. It is unfortunate, but it is true. But this, Chair, this work must, in the long term, not in the short term, be extended to reach every South African, because this has to be a change of mind, that it's not something that the Department of Justice can sit in its corner and prevent all these ills of society. Just like what the Chair had said earlier, we need to change the society mindset. We need to ensure that people understand their constitutional rights and obligations in terms of treating each other as citizens of this country. And that's the only thing that I can say. It is true that it is not, it is, that change has not happened sufficiently on the ground. Chair, I must also indicate that in looking at cases that have been reported, and the stakeholders were complaining that those cases are moving very slow in the system, in the justice system. We tracked those cases. Some of the cases we have since finalized, and that the justice system has already finalized. And we had numbers that, unfortunately I don't have them, but I do know that there were 21 cases that were alleged to have delayed in the system, and indeed 14 of those had indeed delayed in the system, and of those 14, most of them have since been finalized. What we are doing now is we are going through those cases that were regarded as cold cases by SAP and the prosecutor and the prosecution, and we are saying how can we look at these cases better and check if indeed they can still be prosecutable going forward. We don't know what the outcomes will be, but that's the work that is happening now on the ground. Let me then talk about our performance in relations where we have been over the years to where we are this during the reporting period. I must indicate three things in relation to the culture of performance generally in government. Firstly, we were coming from many years of reporting quantitatively over the years, and I'm raising this issue because it was one of the issues that was raised earlier. It wasn't until 2010, 2011, and 11, 12 that we started ironing out our targets, our indicators, making them smart. We can't even say we are there yet, but we've made significant progress. So you will notice that in that graph, in 2011, 2012, we were disclaimed for performance information. That was because our targets were not smart, and we didn't achieve them, and our information was not measurable. In 2011. In 2011, 2012, we performed very poorly. We only achieved 28%. It doesn't mean we performed poorly in terms of all the resources that we had, but we didn't have supporting documents to support our performance. We improved the following year only but just, and in 2013, 2014, it's the first time that we actually performed quite significantly against our targets. That's because our targets were a lot smarter than they have been in the previous year. So we are heartened by that. But the comment that says that our targets are more quantitative, that comment has a lot of merit in it, but in part because most of the things that we have to do are compliance in nature, and therefore look for the type of performance. I must indicate that. So what are the things that we believe we achieved in improving access to justice, insofar as physical infrastructure is concerned? We were able to complete the Kasipa Magistrates Court during the year under review. 36 magisterial districts in the Northwest Gauteng have been aligned with municipal boundaries, as indicated. We are starting with the implementation of the redemarcated boundaries by the 1st of December 2018, if all goes according to plan. 5 branch courts, which include New Brighton in the Eastern Cape, Gaketo and Soweto, and Soweto and Gauteng, Ezakheni in KwaZulu-Natal, Gqeberha in Western Cape, were converted into full-service courts, providing all services, including civil, criminal, and family law services. This is very important because most of our courts, for a very long time, were not offering full services. And now part of access is to ensure that services are brought closer to the people. Service more claims courts were finalized and established. This then brings us to 293, the total number of small claims courts that are now proclaimed and exist in our country. Chairperson, you know that some small claims courts over the years have not been that functional after they have been proclaimed. In 2013-2014, we went back to all small claims courts to ensure that they are actually operational, so that we know that when we say we have a number, we mean we have a number that works. We are still concerned about the number of women commissioners in the small claims courts. We are still struggling in that area, but that number is continuing to improve. New seven new offices of family advocates were established in 2013-2014. Chairperson, this is very significant because if you look at our performance the previous year, this is an area that suffered serious underperformance the previous year. That was because of capacity in the Office of Family Advocates, and that is why we had to establish new offices. And people may ask why lack of capacity in that environment. In terms of the legislation that was proclaimed in 2010, it made divorces available in regional courts. And as a result, the family advocate services were only available in high courts. We now have to stretch them into regional courts as well, and that is why capacity then became a big issue. We re-established 19 sexual offences courts, and amongst others, in specific terms, we completed 9 that met the blueprint criteria. Now, there was a question whether, in fact, the re-establishment of sexual offences courts, we went the easy route. There is some element of truth in that because indeed most of our buildings are very old and some of them are heritage buildings and we can't change them. You can't break them and put door here and all of this here and there. And as a result, we first started with those court environments where we didn't have to do too much physical construction of the work. You will see that numbers we will be doing a lot less each year because then that's where hard work comes in, the breaking of the buildings comes in. But in the courts that are going to be built anew, then we are going to put the requirements of the sexual offences courts as part of the infrastructure going forward. Self-delivery. This is one area where Chairperson, in spite of the comments that were raised by our colleagues, stakeholders earlier, we believe that we are doing a great job, even if we say so ourselves, Chairperson. We accept that in terms of accounting for TPF, we are still far from where we want to be. But Chair, you will see the progress that we are making in the few slides to come. 98% of maintenance beneficiaries are now paid via EFT. And obviously, as a colleague said earlier, this makes the money readily available to them at a lot shorter periods than they used to wait before. 96% of the Guardian Fund recipients receive their money through EFT systems. Again, this is very critical, especially because in these environments, you will find that there are a lot more families that are child-headed. And if they get their money sooner, it means you then provide that relief that they would otherwise have had to endure if they had to wait weeks for their money to be paid to them. During the year under review, 341,784 requests for default judgments were received by the department, and 283,888 were dealt with by the Glass of Courts within the required period, which is 14 days. I wish to pause here, Chair, and explain this. Before 2013-2014 financial year, we were not measuring in the strict sense of the word the default judgment. It wasn't part of our target necessarily. We started in 2012-2013, and in 2013-2014, it then became the very first year that we could say how fast we can do this work. We are mindful of the concerns that were raised by the committee here in the, I think last year when we presented our report, when the committee said, check the quality of these default judgments because some people are not served properly and people then take default judgments. We've gone back to our sittings and we can confirm that some of the concerns that the committee raised are indeed correct, and we are working behind the scenes to try and correct those where there hasn't been proper service or where, and we have found that there are unscrupulous lenders who force people to consent to jurisdictions other than in areas where they reside, and therefore default judgments get, if you reside in KZN, default judgments get taken in Limpopo, and obviously it becomes impractical for you to get there. So those are things that we are working on to try and address behind this, and we must be grateful to the committee for raising that issue because at that point it was not known to us. Chairperson, we also started a fast tracking our work and tracking it for quality purposes on citations. Because we do believe that if a matter has been finalized in court, you still have not received justice unless you have been paid all your monies, including those who make in the system. You can see, Chair, that we have been able to meet our targets in that area. And again, like the default judgment, it's an indicator that is relatively new, and we are still trying our hand in it as we move forward. Case law management forums were established, Chairperson, and this is very critical in terms of ensuring that court cases move speedily within the justice system. The first two modules in terms of the paperless estate administration system, which we call the PL system, was finalized, and this assists us to curb fraud and loss documentation in the mother's environment. The AG spoke earlier, amongst others, about us not having an ability to keep documentation. And in the masters, this is where we decided to start in creating paperless environments. But it's a project that we believe in the next 20 years should be employed within the totality of the department. Over 10,000 cases of expungements and pardons were dealt with by the department. Over 43 million cases have been digitized in terms of the project that we have explained to the committee the previous year, and in the 9 biggest courts. We are also very happy with this project, albeit that it is running toward the end and we do not have resources to continue with it going forward. But we are very happy with the work that we have done in this area, because we've digitized in the main courts a number of records, but also we've created a little bit of space because we didn't have space in keeping court files, and with the digitization we've given ourselves that opportunity. The audiovisual remand system was rolled out, as we have been reporting, in 47 magisterial in magistrate courts linked to 21 correctional facilities. This work, Chairperson, has two implications for us. On the one hand, we are very happy with the project, and we have said we wanted to monitor the project and not continue the number of the EVRs in court, at least until we see that the project is sustainable. We have picked up that in some courts, they are not using the AVR system, so we used 2013-2014 to try and clean up that process and ensure that we move the AVR to where it is going to be used. Our view is that we may be moving legislation to make it compulsory for AVR to be used in every court, because right now it's quite optional between the judiciary and the prosecution to ensure that AVR is used. There is actual benefits where AVR is being used, where transportation of people who are in correctional services to court is no longer happening. So you save on people running away. I don't know what's the right word. Escape, yes, escape. You save on escape and all of that. But because it is not legally binding for obligatory to do it, there are some prosecutors that have not been doing it. In terms of the delivery, the Departmental Annual Service Delivery Awards, we held one last year, we've just held one this year, and we do believe that this is inspiring our staff and encouraging our staff to improve service delivery all the time. We also improved our own administration. Chairperson, I have spoken about us being disclaimed in 2010, 2011, and having performed very badly in 2011, 2012 financial year. The reason for that was that our own administration was not very great. One of the reasons was that we had a serious capacity problem at executive management level. We since filled positions of EDG Corporate Services, the Chief Financial Officer, and DG Legislative Development. Chairperson, I indicate that an organization that's run without a CFO for 4 years is bound to be in trouble, and obviously we have been in trouble as a consequence. 1,239 posts were also filled during the period under review, and therefore we fell within the normal vacancy rate, which is 9.98. Even though, having said that, we do believe that there is we could do better in filling positions, but we have struggled to fill some specific positions of a specialized nature because of some problems that we have with occupational specific dispensation. It's something that they are addressing, but I just thought it's important that we raise. We also made a big breakthrough last year in finalizing grievances of our staff. This was an area we were struggling with for years, and we think we have found a breakthrough, and we are trying to sustain this and so that it becomes sustainable going forward. The numbers speak for themselves. Chairperson, last year when we presented our report, I bragged a bit and I said, one of the things that we have been doing well in the Department of Justice, and we fall among the top five perhaps departments, is finalizing the presidential hotline cases on time. And this year we stood at 85%, and we have been in that range for the past 2, if not 3 years. And it's an area that we have invested a lot of time in to understand how to deal with it, and we are quite confident that we can continue this performance going forward. We were regarded by the Department of DPME in the presidency as one of the best performing departments in terms of service delivery, looking at our service delivery instruments that we have in the department. I must say though, Chair, when you read the MPAT report, you will also notice that there were areas we did not perform well. But in this area of service delivery, we believe that we are performing quite successfully. We've made significant progress in the development system of the integrated justice system. We will be reporting in specifics later in this annual report, Chair. During the period under review, the Department of Justice was the coordinator of the GCPS cluster. So this report speaks to the work that we did during that period. This year, and going forward, that responsibility has shifted to the Department of Defense and Military Veterans. During the period under review, therefore, we finalized 136 cybercrime-related cases, obviously through the NPA, and that gave us a rate of 97.8%, and we were very comforted by that because it's a relatively new area in terms of the prosecution. More than 800 persons are currently under criminal financial forensic investigations. Some at the point in time had already gone through pre-trial proceedings initiated against 298 persons by the end of December 2013. The rest of the numbers there, Chair, speak for themselves. I would like to then move to the challenges that continue to face the department, and that if the Honourable House were to assist us in engaging with these problems, we would be dearly, dearly grateful to the committee. We have been experiencing a lot of shortfalls in operational expenses insofar as our infrastructure is concerned. We had 347.6 million capital works which we could not spend as a result of the delays associated with our sister department. And obviously, if you do not spend your money, it does go. It's just as unfortunate. Similarly, we could not spend 128 million for IJS projects to procure a system. Because obviously of our sister organization, CETA. We've had endless engagements, and I think just last week we received a letter that among others, seeks to assist us in dealing with our VPN, and we are very grateful to the CEO and the board of CETA for that. And why is VPN important, Chairperson? It's because all our ICT interventions that we are doing, whether EFT payments, whether digitization and the like, we have to use VPNs to migrate that information from one point to the other. So we are very grateful for that, even though there remain other challenges that we still must resolve with Twitter. So which are these projects that became affected the most? It was the court digitization, the DCRF project. It was affected quite greatly. The colleagues from the stakeholders raised a concern about the TPS system. It was the CPS system that was also affected by the delays that were associated with the procurement through CISA. We have escalated these matters naturally in trying to seek support and assistance, and indeed, as I indicated, at least we succeeded on one in CISA, and as well as CISA allowed us in the end to procure the DCRS through the then Minister of Public Service and Administration, and that process is nearing completion. The OSE, which is the Occupational Dispensation for Legally Qualified Officials, remain a problem. And that in what it is a problem that we are seeking the assistance of the Public Service and Administration for us to get over this problem, we must take full responsibility for having not implemented OSD originally correctly, which is why they then closed the system on us. So we are embargoed. We can't appoint people at senior levels of the OSD, which is MP10s and to some extent some LP9s as well. And the state attorney, the chief state law advisor, the family advocate, and legislation in the department, as well as in other parts of the Department of Justice, have been affected by OSD quite significantly, including NPA, the public protector, and the like. Sorry, should I go back? We have been funding commissions, as we indicated, Chairperson. We had anticipated that all the commissions would have finalized its work or their work by now. Unfortunately, that had not been the case. They have requested and received extensions, and therefore this obligation is still going to continue to be in our books going forward. Chairperson, this is our history of performance from 2008-09 to 2013-2014 financial year. The reason we are showing the Honourable House this slide is we want to give assurance to this Honourable House that the issues that have been raised by our colleagues who are our stakeholders around our administration, we take it very seriously. But having said that, we have had to grow over the years to ensure that our administration improves so that we can also focus on everything else that we need to focus on. Chairperson, you will see that in the last 2 years, we have improved in managing our voted funds, in managing our performance information, in managing our funds, such as the Guardian Fund, CARA Fund, as well as the President Fund. We have improved quite significantly care in these areas, but we are not where we should be, which is receiving clean audits for the vote account while our funds are already clean. There is only one fund which remains a problem that our colleagues, stakeholders, as well as the Auditor General spoke about and said we have still disclaimed, which is the Said Happy Fund. We are not very proud, Chairperson, that we are, in fact, we are very humbled by some positive feedback that we received insofar as the performance side of the fund. But clearly, on the accounting side of the fund, there is a lot of work that must be done. Chairperson, I must indicate this because sometimes when we say we are making progress and the Auditor General comes back and says, no, we haven't made as much progress, and I don't mean this in a negative way, we may appear to be sending mixed messages to the Honourable House. I want to again reiterate that we are making progress, Honourable Members. Only it that the progress we are making has not given us the outcome that we want. I want to just give the highlight some of the things that we have been doing in the past 2 years or even three. We worked on the financial statements for the 5 years in the past 2 years, and we have finalized them. That is why we are giving ourselves a green there. We improved on the basic controls. While not all courts are doing daily reconciliations, the monthly reconciliations, some courts have started because of the disciplines that we have introduced. We have capacitated the TPF environment, albeit it's not adequate. We've identified the errors in, at court level, and our business policies continue to improve. But we are not procured a system as yet. In other words, even though it's in the process of procurement, it has not started. We have not finalized the procurement so that we can start using it. And that is why, in part, we would not have turned the corner, including all the issues that the Auditor General has indicated. Chairperson, I must also add that I agree with the observations of the Auditor General, and I do not dispute them. What work have we done in the TDF environment? First, we have had to look at the policy environment, whether we need legislation or not. We've been toing and froing between ourselves and our colleagues in Treasury, whether or not we must account for TPF separately or not. As we sit here today, we cannot tell you which is which. Safe to say that it's an ongoing engagement. We've improved on processes quite significantly, Chairperson. Some of them, unfortunately, are very manual because of the JDA system being what it is. But we can assure the Honourable House that work is work that we do on a daily basis. Insofar as technology is concerned, Honourable Members would recall that we said we were going to start the procurement process. I had just indicated in the earlier slide the two projects that were laid by CISA was the DCRS system and the TPF system. DCRS system, ultimately CISA gave us permission to procure directly, and then the TPF system they just finalized, and we are now going through the contracting mechanism, and therefore it will take us between 18 to 24 months to start implementing any element of that system. We have, however, improved even in the existing system, the current JDA system, as I indicated, that we are already paying 98% of our beneficiaries via the EFT system. People, we are resourcing at supervisory and technical levels. We are training a lot of our people at court levels in terms of TDF. We are also training on service delivery and etiquette at court level, which is an area that I think was raised by the colleagues earlier. So I can confirm that it's a problem that we have been aware of, but it's also a problem that we are addressing. The financial data for auditing purposes has been indeed a problem, but it's a problem that we are addressing, Chairperson. The historic data, there's very little we can do about, and we have engaged the Auditor General quite aggressively on that, but we do believe that on the current and the future data, it's something that we can address. And in terms of providing oversight, the Honourable House would know that one, Mr. Johnson, who has been acting as the CFO from 2010 to date, well, not to date, from 2010 to September 2018, has now gone back to be the chief director responsible for TPX and Carafan. And we do believe that with this function now having someone looking after it, we should start seeing the improvements. Now, we wanted to show this Honourable House how we have improved our administration by just showing you the number of findings that we have received at regional court level from 2009-2010 to where we are today. Obviously, we are not where we should be, but clearly, if you look at this graph, it shows you that in 2009-2010 financial year, we had 264 findings from the Auditor General, and in 2013-2014 financial year, those were brought down to 23. And in my view, that is a huge improvement. Obviously, ideally, we do not want to have any findings of any nature, but where we are, we believe we are quite comfortable. Okay, then in terms of the audits at the national level, for the past 5 years, you can see that we started at 207 in 2009, 2010, 10 financial year, and at the end of the financial year, we were down to 35, and we need to do a lot more work there to ensure that we bring these findings down. Chairperson, the reason why this information becomes important for the Honourable House is that when we say we are improving, you need to know what were the big problems that we were having. The Auditor General earlier said some of our interventions were not addressing the root causes of the problems. And what we are doing now is that starting this year in 2014-2015, because at some point we needed to start somewhere, we needed to address the findings. Now in 2013-2014 financial year, in how we have developed our audit action plan, we've gone now into the root causes. So you will find that when you look at our audit action plan, it has a lot more issues than the issues that were raised by the Auditor General, because in that exercise we also discovered some areas where the AG had not advised us to look for root causes, that we were still not addressing those root causes. So going forward, that is where our focus is going to be. Our overall financial and audit overview is as follows. And I'm just going to look at, when you look at this, I'm focusing only on the headline spending at this point in time. If you look overall, our spending has been on average at 6%. Compensation of employees, 8%. Goods and services, 10%. Machinery and equipment, 10%. CapEx, which is capital work. You will recall that I said 340,000 could not be spent because public works. You can see that number, we are in the red there as a consequence. We've also improved on payment of creditors, as you will see in the slide to follow. And honourable members were very worried that we were not paying our creditors within the 30-day period. We have improved in this area quite significantly. However, there are those creditors we are still not paying within 30 days, and we are refining our own processes in the department to ensure that we do pay within 30 days. Now, this slide is giving you a sense, where were we in 2011-2012, where were we in 2012-2013, and 2014. In 2011-2012 financial year, we were not paying to the tune of 814 million. Were not paid within 30 days. The following year, that number came down to 286. In the reporting period, we were down to 119 million not having been paid on time. So at the end of the financial year, the amount of accrual has decreased from 492 million down in 2011-2012 to 9 million in 2013. And even during on quarter to quarter, these figures are improving going forward. We then look at cost drivers. What are the key cost drivers for us, the Department of Justice? The biggest cost driver for us is building leases. It's water and electricity, it's security. Travel and accommodation, we've brought down to a manageable level. We can still do better, as well as computer services, data lamps, transversal systems, and the like. Those are, in the main, the key cost drivers for us as the department. The telecommunications remains an issue, but it's not an issue that we are more worried about. We are very worried about psychological evaluations as well as transcription services. Now, why are we worried about psychological evaluations? If they're not done, it means that this is not done. And you can see that in our budget, it takes 20% of our budget. That's the, sorry, no, sorry, just a minute, just a second. So the average growth is 20%, as well as the average growth of transcription services is also 14%. My apologies for that. Now, the reason why we are concerned about the psychological evaluations is that we've engaged the Department of Health quite significantly in this area, because that service is offered by them. And the work that is happening behind the scenes, but we are not thinking that it will give us an outcome that we are looking for, perhaps in this year and even in the new year. Hopefully, if there are any improvements, they may come through in the next 2 years or so. We have been told that our budgets will be cut. We are very sad about this, but we are also South Africans, and we know that we cannot continue to grow the deficit of the country in the manner that we have been doing generally. So where are these cuts coming from? It's in the compensation of employees. As you can see, in 2015-2016 financial year, we will be down to the cut will be 74 million. In goods and services, the cut will be 95 million, and the machinery and equipment will be 29 million. Obviously, the SIU did not escape this. They will be cut by roughly 9 million, and the legal aid South Africa will be cut by 61 million. The following year, the cut follows 19 million compensation. It means what does this mean? It means that we will have to employ a lot less people. Goods and services, you will see that 219 million in goods and services. So even if we were to employ people, we will not have money to provide them with a good a budget for goods and services, then machinery and equipment. Really, in South Africa, you will see the cut is quite massive. It's 92 million won. In the SIU, the cut is only 12 million. But a cut is a cut, and therefore we remember that our overall strategies are planned on a 5-year horizon, and obviously when you start having budget cuts of that nature, it does affect the types of services that you can offer. Chairperson, I might just clarify these cuts, that once the colleagues from the civil society had said we need to capacitate and put more people in court, clearly the resources are saying something different. They said we need to train more, but the resources are saying something different. We will do our utmost endeavor to ensure that we train those people that are overworked, as we have said earlier, so that they can do the work smarter, which is why we need to invest in ICT so that we improve that. Just looking at the budget reductions in the maintenance infrastructure, the transformation of stadium services will be affected. The introduction of paralegals as registrars will also be affected. The introduction of mediators through the ADRM will also be affected. Government systems relating to Legal Practice Act will be affected. We apologize for that bill there. The small claim court re-engineering program, while it may not be affected that much, but it will still be affected because donor funding is also dying out in that area. Violence against women and children will be a victim, capacitation of new courts, technical capacity, the LGBTI and the PPI regulator will also be affected by the baseline reduction. Obviously, our services will not be the same as we had planned originally. We will focus, obviously, on improving access to justice, but there will be those areas where we can build new courts and we can do the redemarcations going forward in the shortest of time that is required. We then move to programmatic performance at the program level. In this area, perhaps the Honourable House will say, why do we perform 91% of the target against the target of 50%? This is an area, Chair, where we had no capacity originally, and we have built capacity somewhat, and that is why our target was brought down to 50%, because a lot of people left. But in here, we were then able to bring in new people to help us with that work. And then we were also able to finalize a lot more forensic investigations, and that has assisted us quite significantly as a department. This is an area, Chairperson, where we are really, really struggling in the nursing environment. We are having a serious revolving door syndrome. We employ people and they leave because other departments or specialized environments do pay a lot better than we do as the Department of Justice. Unfortunately, the turnover is extremely high. The comments is there for the honorable members to see. What are the biggest challenge with security in the department? It is very well known that we have courts that require a lot of security. We are seeing a lot of courts being shootings in court environments happening, something that we had thought that it was beginning to disappear in the past 3 years or so. It has come back quite aggressively, therefore it challenges our security budget going forward. The people are intimidated. I mean, as late as yesterday, we were listening on the radio and they were saying the police or mother got shot and the family got shot and all of that, and these things are worrying us because they do affect the work that we do in our in the court, and they do affect the security that we have, both for the prosecution as well as for the judiciary as well, but also the offices of the Department of Justice are affected by that. We are working on that behind the scenes, Chair, and we will be arriving the Honourable House if the situation becomes unbearable, but we are very concerned. We have been engaging within the JCPS CASA environment, the ability of the staff as well as defence in some instances to migrate some of their capacity to us if they are no longer using it for policing and or defense purposes. But we have not yielded any result as yet because it's an ongoing conversation. In terms of IT, Chairperson, IT is extremely, extremely necessary in the empowering our work going forward and supporting our strategy. We are doing well in some instances, but As I indicated earlier, our VPN has not been able to carry us, which is why if honourable members go on site visits, you will find that people will say your EFTs are now paid a lot slower than they used to before. That's because our VPN network has not been working that great. But this is a matter that I've just reported that we've resolved with Twitter just about a week ago. IBMS, third-party funds is an area that I just reported on, and we are finalizing that work going forward. In the short Chairperson, maybe on this area, because I've covered JDAP and EFT, maybe I do not need to explain it anymore. It will be necessary for members to read, but I don't think we should be speaking to it necessarily, including this slide. The only one thing that I want to talk to this slide on, because the Honourable Committee asked us about the disaster recovery solutions, will be Bullet B, which talks about implementing a disaster recovery solution for the department. That is in place. I must indicate that we are now working on populating the disaster recovery site. We've had a lot of difficulties between ourselves and CITA, but we received some approvals towards the end of last year to be able to start moving our disaster recovery site to an area that is a lot closer to us than having it somewhere in Witbank or thereabouts. The modernization project, Chairperson, I will not talk to in detail. This is an area that we had requested the committee to trust the mission to come and present specifically so that we can talk about modernization at a cluster level. But it's there for honorable members to see. We are very excited about the work, so we are looking forward to come and present it, Chair, going forward. So I will pass all of these and move to the TRC. Chairperson, you may have read recently an article saying where has the TRC money gone to. We would like to assure this Honourable House that the TRC money has not gone anywhere. It is there. We had a workshop with the stakeholders, including Kulmani, support group and its own organizations, and we explained the audited financial statement of the President's Fund, we are comfortable that the money has not disappeared. Just on the work front, I will just focus on the fact that the work on the TRC has gone according to how we had planned it. The only difficulty has been the regulation around basic and higher education, the health regulations, as well as the human settlement regulations. We've just published the regulations on the community rehabilitation. We've received a lot of comments, and it's well in progress. We will come back to this Honourable House as soon as we have finalized that process. Certainly on the re-burial, I do not have to speak in specific terms any more than it is there in the presentation. So that was the administration part of the department. I then moved to the line function, court services. Again, here we talk about maintenance. Now, at a slightly different level, we talk about maintenance at court level, not at payment level. Again, the presentation speaks for itself in this area. It's an area that I can just assure our stakeholders that we are putting all efforts to ensure that people are trained regularly at court level. We do believe that maintenance does contribute to gender-based violence, because sometimes gender-based violence arises because people do not want to pay maintenance for their children. And that is why we focus a lot of energy on improving maintenance. I will not deal with that detail, because I had already spoken to it a little while earlier. I would like to move with it to the National Register for Sex Offenders. Chairperson, we had thought that we were going to achieve a lot more better numbers in the previous financial year in terms of the sexual offences in terms of the register. However, we had struggled because most of the information was not purified, and as a result, we were not able to achieve our targets. But we have now had a very good working relationship with SAP and Correctional Services are now our sister, and therefore the information that is coming from those environments is beginning to be cleaned up for this purpose. We were able to meet our targets for this current year, and our performance has been improving since the establishment of the Sexual Offences Register. We do remain with the challenge on historic information because our systems as the government and the systems of the criminal justice system were not designed to capture all the detailed information in the manner that was required in terms of the Act. And that work is moving, but it's not moving at the current pace of the current convictions, which we then capture them as and when they happen. Chairperson, we have improved in protecting the rights of children in particular. As I indicated that in the previous year, our performance was not very good, and that is why we have had to improve the capacity in the Office of the Family Advocate. We do believe that our performance going forward is indeed going to improve quite significantly. But this year, because this is when the offices were established, naturally the performance was not consistent with the number of capacity that we brought into place. In terms of building new courts, we did launch Gandendale courts. In 2013-2014 financial year, we've just discovered about a day or two ago that maintenance is not offered in that court, and we are going to be addressing that so that maintenance is offered in that court. Bulawayo Magistrates Court was under fire, and we have not finalized that, but the Bulawayo High Court on the other hand is almost complete. We are hoping that it will be completed this current financial year. In Mpumalanga, site has been handed over, it has been clear handed over, construction is commencing, and we hope that court could be finalized in time, now that it was so delayed for such a long time. other imminent projects, Mamelodi Magistrate Court, the Palace of Justice, since it was on fire in 2010, Hotel Elizabeth High Court, as well as the Pretoria Magistrate Court, will be restarted going forward. Actually, it's the Pretoria Magistrate Court that was on fire in 2010. Then we go to the state legal services. Now, in the state legal services, some of the functions that reside there are the master's functions, the state attorney's functions, the chief state law advisor functions, as well as the legislation and development. In so far as the matter is concerned, the Master of the High Court services in Barberton, Sudan, and Goma, Bridge Magistrates Court have been established. You will note that these services did not exist in these sites that we've indicated. I have spoken about introducing the paperless system. The honorable members will recall that when we opened the Dala Uma Center here, we showed how the paperless system is supposed to work, and indeed it is working very well where we have already introduced it. We are implementing it successfully. We are also implementing some other systems to of an IT nature to assist us to keep the fraud as well as loss of documents, because obviously in the paperless system there's a lot of scanning of information that resides there. The system will therefore be rolled out throughout the master's environment. But obviously, with the ballot card, we will have to review which sites we will implement in, depending on the availability of resources. In terms of the trust, the guardian fund, as well as insolvency and deceased estates, a lot of work has been done in that environment, and our performance is indeed improving. However, I must indicate that we need to still build a lot of capacity for access in rural areas, because some of these services are not as polished in rural areas as they are in the cities, and it's an area that we want to invest in going forward. Now, thank you very much. In terms of enhancing litigation terms, I'm no longer going to narrate, I'm just going to go straight to the target. We had a target of 5% met it. We had a target of 50% success in the court cases, and we agreed that that target, please do not think that that target is low, because at that stage our capacity in the state attorney, as I indicated, it was very bad, and it still is very bad because of OSD impact. PAIA, I think one of the questions that was raised was whether PAIA, why have we not responded to success effectively to the question that was raised. PAIA is indeed working. Obviously, the challenge is associated with PAIA, but we do respond, and we do respond on time, except in some specific areas where there are problems. So you will see that our performance was not great in the current year. That was because of all the lost court records that resulted in us not being able to respond in good time. As we then move to a conclusion, Chairperson, it is always appreciated the support that we get from our leadership, in particular our minister, even the current minister who has just started, has assisted us a lot. But during the period under review, it was Minister Khatebe and the Deputy Minister, Minister Jeffrey, they really assisted in giving us leadership. Our portfolio committee, which we have always been very proud of, because even though we get a lot of hiding from this committee, but we also get a lot of support and guidance, and we are very grateful. The SILAC committee was unbelievable, and we are very grateful to the SILAC committee. They are indeed a lot, kind of. We are grateful to the judiciary, the prosecution, and the legal aid of South Africa. Our civil society partners as well, we are grateful to them. But we must also share to say, the Auditor General, the Audit Committee, as well as our internal audit, we would never have made this progress without without those assurance functions. Chapter 9 institutions, as well as the staff of the department. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much. get any flack from us, because we are doing a lot of good work. And I guess our civil society friends will agree that some of the things they raise, because they only have to wait for this meeting to get information. Maybe if they look at me a newsletter so you can update all of us, then we'll have less stress. But this is brilliant work. We are very proud of that. Yeah. So we'll break for lunch. Honorable Smith, come at 2 o'clock and then take the other part and then engage. Is that fine? Is that true? Honorable Mazen? Oh, I see. Honorable Mula? It's 1:20 now. We have to come back at 2. Once we start, it means there's no lunch. And it's the Honorable Schwartz and myself are all people. We need to eat.